Hello, everyone, and welcome to Between the Sheets, episode 20. Yeah, we're 20 weeks in. We got a good show for you tonight, as we're going to be discussing December 1st through the 7th, 1992. And, of course, I'm joined tonight by my co-host, David Bix and Span. Bix, how you doing?
I'm doing well. I guess it's a tradition, though, as our listeners are about to learn, unless they looked at the description. God damn it. I guess it's going to be a tradition that if we cover that week, the first week of December, because we're doing sort of doing it 2 weeks in a row, that we're going to have a Jewish guest.
Yes, we are. And
happy Hanukkah in 2 hours, David.
Yeah, and happy birthday as we're recording this, a couple hours to me too.
Oh, wow.
Wow. What are you, 21 this year?
How old are you, David?
I'm going to be 31.
Holy shit.
It makes me feel old when you're that old.
Yes, me too.
Phil too. But speaking
of, I am old.
Yeah.
Hello, I'm Phil Schneider.
Yeah, it's Phil Schneider, everyone, from Death Valley Driver and Segunda Caída, a legend in the rest of the internet.
And Digging in the Crates.
Digging in the Crates, of course. A great show on this very own PWO Place to Be Nation network.
You mean the shitty award-nominated PWO Place to Be Nation network?
We're all shitty award-nominated. Yes.
I, until 5 minutes ago, had no idea what that was. But now I know I am nominated for it. And as I mentioned to you, I am just happy that Eric was not.
So, Eric Ritz, everyone. Phil's cohort.
Yes. Doing
the Caída.
Or Dean.
For those... Yeah.
So I don't care if I win, but just as long as I was nominated and those jerks weren't.
And for those of you that don't know what we're talking about, go to sheetsandwich.com, and your list of nominees are there. You'll see myself, Fix, Phil, this show, Exile on Bad Street, and
PWO, yeah, Place to Be Nation Network.
Yeah, this network is for Best Podcast Network, so vote and vote often, as they always say. Yeah. So, go check that and send your votes to @ProWrestling. Less More on Twitter. That's one way of doing it, or email him in, I guess. So
yeah, whatever anyway. His email address is, but he opens up his DMs, so you can. I think you're supposed to just DM it to him if you're doing it on.
Okay, well that's what I did. So check him out on Twitter @ProWrestling. All right, let's get to the business at hand here as we're discussing December 1st through the 7th, 1992. And I want to have Phil on this show anyway, just because we haven't done one with him yet. And as I was doing the notes for this show, the first two stories include two of the greatest pro wrestlers of all time. So it's just a natural fit. So
sure.
We're going to start in the World Wrestling Federation, as Jerry the King Lawler was hired during the week to replace Mr. Perfect as the heel color commentator on Superstars. As Perfect is going back on the road full-time as a babyface wrestler. Lawler's main duties will be the commentary, but also work as a heel wrestler when needed, starting at the Royal Rumble on January 24th in Sacramento. Lawler was introduced on WWF TV for the first time on the December 7th episode of Primetime Wrestling, which was a huge shock for people who didn't know what was going on, as Lawler has been one of the most outspoken critics of the WWF over the years, even doing battle with them in court over the King gimmick regarding Harley Race coming to Memphis using that name. Now, Dave Meltzer reported that Lawler was surprised that the WF contacted him about coming in to replace Perfect, and he said if he agreed the terms with them, he would not go on the road as a full-time wrestler, which they agreed upon. Lawler's current duties will be to fly to Titan Towers every few weeks to do in-studio voiceover work with Mr. Man for Superstars, other TV work when needed, and occasional matches on big shows. It is expected that Lawler will continue to work for the USWA every Saturday morning and every Monday night, along with other appearances. Lawler is expected to remain babyface in the USWA, but will explain it to everyone why he is a heel in the WWF.
And boy, and that did happen.
Yeah, and it got started on December the 5th on TV, where Lawler said he was supposed to defend his unified heavyweight title against a WWF wrestler on the November 30th Mid-South Coliseum show, who was injured. And Vince went and sent a replacement, so the match got canceled. Lawler actually missed the show because he and Jeff Jarrett were filming their roles in the movie Life with Mikey, starring Michael J. Fox in Toronto.
The classic movie, Life
with Mikey. I know, right? Lawler wearing a mask in that movie, by the way. Lawler then said that the wrestler was then rebooked for December the 7th, but he called on December the 3rd and said he was still injured, so had to cancel again. Lawler went on to say that Sergeant Slaughter and the Bushwhackers have worked in Memphis, but Vince is scared to send guys to come in and work against himself and Jarrett. Bring up Bret Hart in particular, as Jarrett is still waiting for the match they agreed to in October. Lawler said that the wrestlers were chicken and were scared that if they came to Memphis, they would lose to guys in a smaller promotion. Now here's where it gets good. 30 minutes later on the show.
It gets good. It didn't get good yet.
Oh, it's getting good now. 30 minutes later on the show, while he was going over to local house shows, Dave Brown was joined by Coco Beware, who showed up saying he was tired of watching the show every Saturday and hearing Lawler put down the WWF every week. So he got tired of it and decided to drive down to the studio to address it. Coco said that nobody in WWF was scared of Lawler, but praised Jarrett, saying that at least Jarrett had the guts to go to a WWF show and challenge Bret Hart face-to-face, unlike Lawler, who never comes to the shows. Coco said that is the reason why Jarrett has been able to work on WWF shows at Boston Garden, while Lawler is stuck in Memphis, which brings out Lawler for some arguing and shoving between them until heel managers Burt Prentice and Mike Samples came out to try and egg it on. Coco told them to shut the hell up and leave before he said Lawler would give his left foot to be in the WWF, but they'd never take him. Lawler then said he could be in the WWF anytime he wanted, but he doesn't want to leave Memphis because he loves the area, the fans, and doesn't want to spend his life traveling. Lawler asked Ware, why would I ever want to go to the WWF? He then said how he's challenged all the big stars in WWF, but none of them have ever shown up to wrestle him. Ware said he was a liar. So at this point, Jarrett and Ari Mahlman came out and said they should conduct their business behind closed doors instead of front of the cameras. And they had a television show they were holding up. At some point in there, they started brawling the course of a match on December the 7th for the Unified title, which drew an estimated 2,500 fans, the largest crowd in 6 months, although kids were admitted free with a paying adult. Ware won the title using an illegal pile driver with outside interference coming from Prentice and Samples. So to explain going to the WWF, Lawler said that Coco wouldn't give him a rematch for his belt, and he said he's going to have to go all over the country to get a title shot. So the reason he's on WWF broadcast is because it's the only way he can run down Ware and get a rematch for his title. The only problem is that Lawler's announcing, not wrestling in the WWF. There's no explanation why he's playing heel in the broadcast, and Ware, who he's chasing all over the country, was coming into Memphis on December the 14th for a title rematch. And Dave said, aside from that, everything makes perfect sense. So, Phil... Yes. We watched a ton of Memphis in the 80s, and Lawler was always a huge anti-WWF guy. And when he showed up on Primetime Wrestling, I remember seeing this.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Watching it live, it felt like hell froze over. Lawler on WWF television. What are your opinions on him finally going to WWF?
Yeah, I remember that too. I remember it being like a lunatic, and I hadn't seen very much Lawler at that point because I wasn't a tape trader in 92. So I mean, outside of seeing some USWA
ESPN,
I don't think I'd ever really seen Lawler before, but obviously it was a Pro Wrestling Illustrated, go to the newsstand and sit and read wrestling magazines while my mom goes shopping kind of kid. So I certainly knew who Lawler was, but yeah, it was crazy. When he showed up, almost as crazy as when Flair showed up, I guess the year before that.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's a good analogy, yeah. Yeah, or even Dusty, in 89 coming in there,
But, or just the guy you'd never expect anywhere. One thing about reading this is, man, I want to see your heel Coco, Coco Ware versus heel Lawler stuff.
Yeah, the thing with Coco was, the way they played the angle off was that he really wasn't heel. He was trying to defend WWF against Lawler, and then when it came time for the match, then he used the illegal pile driver. But if I remember right, he did not stay heel long, because when I was watching 1993 Memphis earlier in the year, he was babyface then and friends with Lawler. So I guess, as Memphis goes, you turned all the time, so it wasn't anything new. But this was the beginning of the WWF run in Memphis, because it's not long after this that guys like Luger and Savage are coming in, and Bix. It kind of revitalized the territory there, because 92 they had some good moments, but it wasn't the same as what it was a few years earlier. So 1993 is a really memorable year for USWA.
Yeah, I mean, things picked up a bit in 92 because of the Moondogs versus Jarrett and Lawler and, I guess, other guys like Fuller feud. But it was really dropping off around this point. And they had shot the angle at the pyramid. How many weeks before this was that?
Well, that was in August. You know,
I
and then
don't
they
think I realized it was that big a gap. Okay.
Yeah, because we did. Yeah, we talked about that on the show. And then they agreed to a match in October, but it never happened.
Right, and then Brett lost the Intercontinental title anyway.
That's why, yeah.
And they eventually, they did do the match eventually with Jarrett versus Michaels, I believe.
Yes.
But yeah, and this did, I'd have to look at as far as business how much it heated things up, but as far as a TV show, I think they're starting to get kind of, this was the first time where things were really starting to get stale, because guys like Eddie Gilbert weren't really around that much, and the Moondogs were kind of fun, but you know, Richard Lee was an okay manager. It wasn't as Memphis-y if you had these lead heels that didn't have as much talking and all that. And the, but then, you have Savage, Sherry, Jimmy Hart, you know, all these people, including former Memphis talent, coming back. And it was huge. And just even the whole alternate universe thing with some of these guys, like Tatanka being a heel for the first time.
Or Vince McMahon. Yeah, that's the Pat Patterson.
Right.
You know?
Howard Finkel.
Howard Finkel, yeah.
Right.
I mean, this was the catalyst of that whole year.
I mean, Howard Finkel, people don't realize if they don't look it up on YouTube, Howard Finkel was a tremendous heel here.
Howard Finkel could have been a great heel manager if they wanted him to.
I just love that one promo where he's like, he's doing the Howard Finkel announcer voice and he's like, "Downtown Bruno, what a stupid name."
So he was a Downtown Bruno was a face against Howard Finkel as a heel.
Yes, in Memphis. Yeah,
weird. Downtown Bruno is tricky as a face. Like of all your guys to work face, it's just like one of the grossest dudes ever.
Well, he worked face in '95 against Brandon Baxter in a manager feud.
Ooh.
And Scott Bowden.
Now, as far as Lawler though. You know, the thing with the King name, I think people don't always realize what actually happened was when WWF came into Memphis with Harley Race as the King, the Edge just said the King.
Yeah.
So that's really?
That's why Lawler sued them. It wasn't that he was using the King gimmick. It was that the ad said the King, and that's it. So that's why he was able to sue successfully, and that's why Race was never able to be the King in Memphis after that. And I'm trying to think what other great Lawler anti-WWF moments are there. There's Vince talking about wrestling being a work for the whole New Jersey commission tax thing. And then Lawler bringing out the newspaper on TV and saying, "See, I knew that I told you that their wrestling was fake."
And of course, Lawler was showing all the clips of him beating up like Hulk Hogan
and Randy Savage. Well, he didn't really even beat Hogan. I love that. Edited the what was it, the false finish or whatever, from the Hogan match, and then and then him having his hand raised because he did win by DQ, I believe.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm forgetting a bunch of.
He cut mini promos on like the and he like
oh, the company champions.
Yeah, company champions.
Yeah, that was the sort of idea behind the whole
unified
against Kerry stuff, right?
Yeah.
He challenged Ric Flair, he challenged Randy Savage, and then later Hulk Hogan or whoever, and they wouldn't accept his challenge because they were just company champions, but world class and the AWA have real world champions who take on all comers. And that was the whole unified title thing. I mean, there were a few things that I wish he kind of did some of the Bill Watts type stuff, because I love the Bill Watts potato videos.
Yes.
Where the whole impetus is, I was watching the WWF and Don Morocco hit Ricky Steamboat with his chair. It was I'll never forget the words, this dilapidated chair. It was like this very obvious, like wooden breakaway chair thing, and then, or it was a stool or whatever it was.
So here's Bobby Eaton giving Tommy Rogers a concussion with a chair.
Right. And then it was two weeks of videos of guys potatoing each other and taking horrific bumps on blown spots. It was, who was it that they said, and he never wrestled again? It was like Steve Constance or someone like that.
Yes, Steve Constance.
That, I mean, that was basically the entire premise of ECW, right? I mean, that whole promotion was one big set of potato videos.
Pretty much. Now, going back to Lawler real quick, Phil, you mentioned about ESPN was the way of watching for a lot of people that didn't have the exposure to Memphis. That was their main exposure to Lawler's work in World Class and USWO and ESPN. And in most of that run, he was a heel and a damn good one in that. So it was, I guess it may have been easier for people to transition to seeing Lawler and WF that way because of how he was portrayed in Texas.
I think also one of the reasons that Lawler's rep was something that was lower among fans of our era at one point than it is now, once you have YouTube and tapes, things like that, is because I think everybody's like, well, Lawler's all cheap theatrics. And in USWA, he really was working 70% cheap theatrics, right? You had this experience as him as a heel where he really was doing a lot of like fake foreign objects and, hide the chain in his mouth.
Watch
stuff.
WWE Network right now. Yeah, that's on there.
whereas, you know, during most of the 80s, he was as a babyface and not really doing that.
Yeah.
And even his stuff in Memphis as a heel wasn't really that kind of stuff.
No, if you watch WWE Network right now, the USWA stuff they put up there this week, especially the Jeff Jarrett match, you'll see a lot of the hide the chain and, stuff with Ronnie P. Gossett and stuff like that. I mean, which I love. It's awesome. But it's not a true indictment of what Lawler was. Right.
I think that was like a lot of what people thought. You see Jerry Lawler, you think, the guy just spending 10 minutes hiding a chain.
Right. His last national exposure was as a babyface. Because when USWA disappeared, he was a babyface.
Yeah, he turned. He turned there later on. Yeah. But everybody remembered the whole stuff with Kerry and stuff like that. So that was what was known.
Right. And it was, it's kind of something that should be brought up, is that he had several years of like consecutive national exposure starting in, I guess you would say, around the beginning of 88, right? Because Memphis gets on Score, which is, at the time, was a pretty widely received cable network, right?
Yeah, they weren't on long, though. Not real, real long.
No, they weren't on long, but then... But he's also on AWA and World Class that year.
Yeah.
And then he becomes kind of a mainstay on and off in Texas. And so he had pretty regular TV, national TV exposure, either in syndication or on cable for a few years. And then, not having newsletters and mostly having PWI and a little bit of, Arezzi's radio show. But, I thought the USWA was gone, because if you remember when Global starts up, they go on TV and Joe Pettisino's, I think it was Craig Johnson, actually, is like, the USWA has been globalized.
Right.
And they made it seem like that there was no more USWA. And then a couple months later, you're looking at PWI and it's like, wait, the USWA still exists.
Yeah.
So he had been off TV for, so he had been off national TV for like a year and a half or so.
Yeah. Well, Lawler isn't the only surprise name in the Royal Rumble, as Carlos Colon, the majority owner of the Puerto Rican-based World Wrestling Council, who holds that group's Universal Heavyweight title, which he won on November 28th in Manatee, Puerto Rico, in an I Quit match from Dick Murdoch, which sounds awesome. While this is probably partially to try and increase interest in the show in Puerto Rico, and also a political favor to further occasional talent exchanges, there's a lot of speculation that Titan is going to attempt to use Colon as a Puerto Rican star to try and rebuild sagging house shows business in certain areas of the country. That's right. That's what Dave said.
New York is crazy.
New York does have a history in the past, particularly during the early 70s era with Pedro Morales, and at other times with Miguel Perez Sr. and Victor Rivera, among others, and even to an extent Antonino Rocca, of attempting to push an ethnic babyface when business in New York has gone down. If that is the case, I don't see this as being successful, because Colon is too old to introduce as a new face, and even though he has been an outstanding drawer in Puerto Rico for years, he got over when he was younger, and he built the company around himself, actually in many ways similar to Lawler. Although Lawler's age, size, he's probably 210 pounds nowadays with no physique compared to just about every other push wrestler in WF, even minus the juice, And in reality, his work would make one thing he'd have a hard time getting over in WWF. He still may be successful based on his incredible gift of gab, which will only be accentuated as a heel, and with so much time per week to get himself over. Now, as reported last week, Tenryu will also be in the Rumble, but that's more of a political favor than anything else, and to a small extent, to increase interest when the show airs in Japan, and for the video which will be released there. It was announced in Japan that the WWF had invited All Japan and New Japan wrestlers to appear on the card as well, but both groups declined. Since New Japan is tied in with WCW, and knowing All Japan's feelings for the WWF, those offers may have been public offers, but there was little chance of any serious negotiations having been done regarding those offers. Now, Carlos Colon, Bix, the young, fiery Carlos Colon, according to Gorilla Monsoon, on that broadcast.
Well, he had to build him up for his run as an ethnic babyface draw at house shows.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that you're going to call him young and fiery.
Anyway, yes, Chris?
This was the only show he worked, right?
Yeah. at the time, I didn't realize that Gorilla, you know, had his involvement as a stakeholder in WWC and that he knew exactly who Carlos Colon was. And then him calling him a youngster was a rib. It still became, like, even to people who knew that, like, it still became this big running joke, though. For
of
years.
Course.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't. Because the thing, so does this mean that, like, Vince and everyone who worked for Vince didn't know that Crockett and Gary Juster and those people had tried this 10 years earlier and that it hadn't worked?
I'm pretty sure they knew, you didn't remember.
I hope so.
Also, is it possible that Meltzer was just full of shit?
I'm kind of leaning towards
that. This feels full of shit-ish to me.
Yeah.
Like, he heard that Colon was in the Royal Rumble and then extrapolated this entire nonsense about him being a ethnic babyface draw out of, like, you know, just...
Just because they did it 20 years ago.
Well, or who knows why he did it. But it
on the table
seems to be, like, not true.
Yeah, I guess the thing to keep in mind is that this was the first Royal Rumble with the outside talent.
Yeah,
was Dougie in this Royal Rumble too?
That
or was
96.
That was 96, but think about it.
94 was Tenryu and Kabuki, right?
Yeah.
95, was there anyone in 95?
Dick Murdoch was in one of them, wasn't he?
Yeah, Dick Murdoch. Dick Murdoch, and was there anyone else?
I can't remember, but...
96 was Doug and Takao Mori.
Yeah.
97 Mil Mascaris and...
Yeah, Triple A guys was involved.
Mil Mascaris, Piero Jr. and Cybernetico. And I think that was the last year until they started doing the surprises, the last 5 years or so, right?
Yeah, but think about this now, okay. Lawler, Colon, and Tenryu were all in the same match. And I don't know if they ever had any exchanges against each other.
Lawler and Tenryu, remember, was a rumored WrestleMania match.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
That would have been awesome. That would still be awesome. Like, if you told me some promotion was booking Lawler versus Tenryu tomorrow, I would be excited. I know Tenryu is technically retired, but...
I haven't watched the retirement match yet. I know I've heard
watched
things
it.
About it.
I watched it, and it was great for nostalgia, but
Okada stinks, and it's not like it's needed to have somebody good in there with
Tenryu. Well, I saw Tenryu with his weightlifting belt.
It was depressing to watch Tenryu try to do stuff that he couldn't do. That's what it was.
My suspicion is I would be depressed watching Okada try things that he can't do. I've seen current Tenryu. I like current Tenryu.
I mean, they had to work near the ropes. So Tenryu could do bumps like that, so he can get up. It was depressing because
the Fujiwara match on that show was awesome.
Yeah, especially considering how Fujiwara looked. He looked like he was 90.
He looked like he was 90 in 1983 too. He's always 90. When does he ever look young?
He's always looked old, but you know he's had a lot of health problems. So I mean, the fact that he did as good as he did is a testament to him.
Yeah.
We're getting off track.
I thought that match was awesome.
It was much better than a lot of people said it was, that's for sure.
Your boy Brian Alvarez liked it, Phil.
He thought it was
the best match on the show.
Who is doubting that match? What more could you possibly want out of that match?
Who do you think would be? I mean, it would be like the guys that are into the you know, the fast-paced matches and stuff like that.
That match was pretty fast-paced. That wasn't
as far as spots. The spot matches. The spot guys.
Anyway, yes. Lawler versus Tenma was like a rumored WrestleMania 9 match for some reason. And that is apparently why Tenma worked those squash matches that aired only in Sweden or whatever it was.
That would have been fantastic.
Yeah, Phil, have you ever seen the Swedish WWF TV Tenryu matches?
No.
Go look on Daily Motion.
Feels like I should have.
So there's a recommendation for everybody. Go check out Tenryu's Swedish WWF matches.
Against, who is it? The White Shadow and Stephen Bartlett?
Ken Howard?
No.
Did he have his team with him?
That would be awesome. It would be like Tenryu would be like seconded by like Kitahara and Hara and all those guys. Like that could be that interpromotional feud. This is war versus the cast of the White Shadow. Have a lot of heat. Like all the, you know, yeah. That's the great thing about those war interpromotional matches. Like anybody needed to be in the wrestling needed to be good. There's so much heat you've enjoyed no matter who it was.
They'd have to have it in one of those Michinoku Pro shows where you had the visible basketball goals in the gym. That'd be where you have to have that at.
Do some spots around the basketball. I think Ricochet and Drew Galloway had an Evolve match this year that had like spots worked around like dunks into Rana's.
yes. Now, Cologne, like I said, there's only has one match there. And even though he worked there in the 60s, you know, underneath, but it's just an interesting deal.
Well, that was where he started out.
Yeah, exactly. But he was in New Jersey, yeah.
That's where he was from. I mean, was he born in Puerto Rico or was he born in New York?
He was born in Puerto Rico and moved to the New York, New Jersey area.
At a very young age,
yeah. Now, also coming into WWF are Rick and Scott Steiner. And they started the houses in early January against Double Trouble.
Double Trouble.
Val and Tony Puccio, a.k.a. Undertakers.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, okay.
Big Val Puccio, that's right.
But this is, now how big was he at this point, though?
He wasn't that big. He was, I think, medium Val Puccio at this point.
So he's about ICW-sized, wide as he is tall, Val Puccio.
Yes, yeah. So they were in Connecticut this past week doing photo shoots. No gimmick change in the works. Speaking of the Steiners, first person claim is that there was no problem whatsoever in putting Scott Norton and Tony Holm over in Tokyo. Also, while WCW is attempting to put out the word that Scott was wanted to go to WWF and Rick was happy with the situation, apparently Rick, although remaining cordial with Bill Watts until the end, something that certainly can't be said for Scott, was of the same state of mind as his brother. So, yeah, when the Steiners in WWF was just, I don't know, it didn't seem right, Phil. I mean, they were WCW guys, and they really didn't have that level of competition to work against. And it just didn't work.
Yeah, I mean, the Steiners are imperfect wrestlers, but they kind of work well when they've got guys who kind of work that high-impact style. And I just don't know if they really had anybody like that.
Case in point.
Outside of, I guess, the Islanders. Were the Islanders around at that point?
Someone was watching. Head Shrinkers.
Yeah. They were
Heavenly Bodies. They had good matches with them. And
Quebecers.
And Quebecers, some. And then Bret Owen, that one match. They had some matches, but they didn't have the variety of opponents that they had in WCW.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess you could even say to the point the Beverly Brothers, because Mike Enos was a good opponent for them. But you know, then they had the issue with the job guys that it became a problem that they had no job guys who they felt could safely take the Steiner spots. So Mike Enos started working under a mask as their personal job guy.
Really?
Yeah.
Why did they just hire some job guys who could take the spots?
I don't know.
Seemed like the easiest solution, right? They had it. Like those people didn't exist. So like at least WCW had those job guys under contract or something like that. Just hire those guys.
Well, and of course the kicker was you have to remember they're dealing with the Chuck Austin lawsuit at this point, I believe.
Oh, okay.
Also, the kicker for all that is
the Steiners are kind of a walking Chuck Austin lawsuit.
at that, for some reason, Mike Enos's masked jobber name was Dan Farron.
I don't get it. Is that a joke?
That's a SoCal guy, Dan Farron. who has promoted shows and been around forever on the newsletter scene. But yeah, that
wasn't there a fake Augie Loya too, and wasn't that also Mike Enos maybe?
I don't know that one, but you know, you would have thought, Phil, talking about the jobbers, that they could have, you know, slid Mike Jackson some money and got his jobber troupe to come up there and
what are you doing?
What am I doing? I'm not doing anything. What are you talking about?
Sounded like you were opening a bag of chips.
Oh, no. I'm an athlete. I don't gotta eat that. Gotta eat that kind of garbage.
But yeah, they could have said, could have got Mike Jackson's troop of jobbers to come up there, you know, and
Ultimate take all the funk.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So Mike Jackson had like a troop of jobbers that it would. Like,
yeah, you didn't know that? The guys like Kent Glover, Jason Walker, all the guys that were working like Georgia, Mid South, Continental, some Crockett in that era, were like Mike Jackson guys. He trained them. And he would bring them with him. He was like the moolah
of like the way Jamie Dundee was for midgets.
Kinda, yeah. He was like their pimp. He was a jobber pimp.
So what about Italian Stallion?
Italian Stallion was not in that group.
No, I know, but he was kind of a jobber pimp, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was a jobber pimp too. Later on, I think he took Mike's gig once Mike stopped doing it. But yeah, Mike had his crew of people there.
It's a weird like wrestling school to go to, where like you've always wanted to be a wrestler, but you're going to go to the wrestling school that guarantees you to be on TV getting your ass kicked every week. Didn't like any of those guys ever graduated onto real wrestling jobs.
I think Rocky, I don't know if Rocky King was part of that or not at the beginning, but you know, he ended up doing something.
So I guess your ceiling is Rocky King?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the bright side, you get to sue WCW and get a nice settlement.
Yeah, of course. Speaking of people that had lawsuits over the years, Terry Taylor was given a tryout as a color commentator.
Well, in a manner of speaking, you mean people who were sued over that same thing.
Yeah, before Lawler was hired. Oh, Terry Taylor.
My favorite thing about Terry Taylor is that he was functionally a backyarder.
Wait, what?
Like he was, like Terry Taylor was functionally like a backyarder, right? Like wasn't the story about Terry Taylor that he was like went with a buddy of his to like a trained wrestling school guy to like a TV taping or something like that? And the promoter saw him and saw he was like this good looking athletic kid, and then just made him a wrestler.
Wait, trained with Flair.
But I don't think he I thought the story was that he did not was not was a television wrestler before having any training at all, because he was kind of like a handsome guy who was like buddies with somebody.
I'm sure there's probably something there, but I do know that Flair was kind of a mentor to him. It wasn't like Stan Lane, but...
Well, of course, because Stan Lane is the only wrestler ever to have been trained by Ric Flair.
I was waiting to set you up for that one, but...
Charlotte, right? Wouldn't she be,
No, Charlotte was not trained by Ric Flair, because Stan Lane is the only wrestler who has ever been trained by Ric Flair.
Stan Lane will tell you that. Yes. Any chance he gets.
What will Stan Lane tell you, Chris?
They tell you where to get laid at on Myrtle Beach, that's for damn sure. Now, the one thing about Taylor is Taylor's after this, he became, actually was hired, I don't know if he was with WWF at the time as a wrestler, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was terrific Terry Taylor. He had started in like September, right?
So yeah, he wasn't being brought in, he just tried out for the job, but, you know.
Is this before or after the Red Rooster?
Way after, yeah.
This is when he left
WCW, went back for a little bit, then went back to WCW. And Terry Taylor's career was just a mess. So, yeah.
I had no memory of your second Terry Taylor run.
He was on the first was he on the first Raw or just the first Raw taping?
He was there on the first Raws. Yeah, if not the very first one, he was on the early ones for sure. He was on the one that the with Flair and Perfect. If I remember, he was definitely
right. I'm trying to remember who he wrestled.
He was as himself. He's basically like 1987 Terry Taylor in 1993.
But he was terrific Terry Taylor as like as kind of glorified job guy, I guess. Because I don't remember him getting wins over anything.
He was a jobber to the stars type.
But not like your Bob Holly jobber to the stars who had entrance music and a gimmick. He was just, it was Terry Taylor with a nickname as a job guy who got offense.
Pretty much. All right. From all accounts, Hulk Hogan isn't coming back anytime soon. Well, okay. although his face is all over the WrestleMania promos. Gee, I wonder why. Because, of course, he came back at WrestleMania. So,
which newsletter was that from?
That was from our friend Dave Meltzer at the Wrestling Observer. WWF had its television time moved from Sunday mornings on KPRR TV in St. Louis starting this weekend due to declining ratings. Wrestling had been in that time slot for 29 years. Wow, the bloom has went off the rose in St. Louis.
Yeah, well, when did Larry Madison get taken out? When did he stop working with them?
We just talked about that on the last episode of Between the Sheets.
But I don't think we talked about when he absolutely finished up with them.
80...
No, because he was still working as like a local representative or something, at least through like 91, because he talked about how he was part of the Busch Stadium show.
Yeah, but he also was an advisor for NWA. Remember?
That's right. But he
how can he do was, that?
Maybe it's a Jimmy Hart type situation. I don't know.
Yeah, this is a big deal, man. Because St. Louis, you know, is the legendary wrestling market and had that TV spot forever with Wrestling at the Chase and all that other stuff. And now it's gone so shitty that they had to be moved. So. Yeah, but we're starting to get in that dark era of wrestling in the mid-90s.
Yeah, and we know what Terry Taylor thinks of dark things.
All American in primetime both did 2.1 ratings this past
week. Boy, I really shoehorned that in.
Yeah, you did. To combat the television rating declines, expect some format changes during the early part of the next year. Primetime wrestling will undergo a change starting with the January 11th show. Although I'm not clear of the details, Dave saying that. Slam and Jam, a new WWF show starting on January 9th on the USA Network in a weekly Saturday afternoon time slot, it'll also have a new format, which it didn't. It was so new that they moved to the Saturday mornings.
and didn't call it Slam and Jam.
Yeah, exactly. They changed the name up.
When was Raw announced?
The week after we're doing.
Okay.
Yeah, so it was the week after this is when they announced Raw. But Phil, I don't know if you ever – were you watching the early Raws live at the time?
When was that? End of 93? I think
early
so.
93.
Yeah.
January 93.
Early 93, yeah. So I would have been high school, so I think I was. Although, you know, at that point it was still probably primarily a WCW fan.
You know, it was different because, you know, we had primetime wrestling for so long with that, you know, the same type of format, you know, studio stuff. And now you're live every – other week, you know, from this, you know, cool venue, you know, at the time, and having on this different style of wrestling, you know, it changed the game forever in the wrestling business, no doubt. But at the time period, what did you think of the early episodes of Monday Night Raw?
I remember thinking, what's his face was a real dipshit. Who was the
Bob Bartlett?
Oh God, I remember that's all my only real memories of it is that they got rid of Heenan, right?
No, well, Heenan, they didn't know they did have Heenan as the – it was Heenan, I thought, Vince, I thought Heenan, the, Bartlett.
I thought the thing was they threw Heenan out.
Like, yeah, they did.
But then he shows up anyway, and then they threw at the end of the year when he left, they Gorilla threw him out of the WWF.
Oh, right. So I remember being a bummer. Because, you know, Heenan was so much better than whatever, like, you know, terrible drive time shock jock from, like, they got to do the –
what would you call him? Imus's like number three?
Yeah, he was like he was
he was a poor man's Fred Norris?
Yeah, or Jackie Martling.
Jackie Martling, yeah.
Yeah, he'd be Imus as Jackie Martling. But he didn't last long because it was Vince Bartlett and Savage, and then became Vince Savage and Heenan as your Raw announcers.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean I thought it was a cool place, you know. I love that venue, and the fans were rowdy. It was a different type of fan base than you saw on WWF television.
It was
even WCW television.
It was a hardcore fan base. I mean, it was just very different. It was kind of like the mood of the show was kind of Memphis-y,
yes,
I would say. And the crowd was kind of like a Northeast indie crowd for the era, at least almost. Kind of an ECW-ish, TWA-ish crowd, I guess would be
right.
The best way to put it. But not too terrible. I mean, they were good. I mean, I thought they added to the shows. I don't think there's too much more to say about it. I mean, the one thing I really like though is that if you've ever been to or seen other shows from the Grand Ballroom at the Manhattan Center, WWF was the only one that actually they put bleachers on the stage. Like,
yes.
Like, Raw at the Manhattan Center looks nothing like other wrestling shows from the Manhattan Center.
No, it, yeah, especially like if you watch Handheld. You would know the same building.
Yeah.
And one thing, you know, they had, you know, Flair and Perfect did the, you know, the second show, did the big Lose Leave Town match. And it had, you know, they had like specific feuds just on that show, like the, was it Shawn and Duggan feud?
Shawn and Duggan, which was great.
Which was just a Raw feud. You know, it was really fun. The Lumberjacks and all that stuff. And, you know, when the stuff with Jannetty, you had, you know, 1-2-3 Kid or the Kid becoming the 1-2-3 Kid, beating Razor. Yeah, Raw was a really fun show at the beginning. And then I think once they moved out of the Manhattan Center and went started going to different venues.
I thought the Poughkeepsie shows were still good.
Poughkeepsie shows were fine, but I think once they left Manhattan Center, they lost that charm and they didn't get it back for a while.
Well, you know, but they did a lot of. They did a lot of shows in Poughkeepsie, but I think once they left Manhattan Center for good, like when it stopped being Poughkeepsie Manhattan Center back and forth.
They just started doing that all that Indian casino,
right? And what was the place? Oh, when they would go to like Foxwoods or wherever, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it just didn't have that charm.
Didn't they go to a place called Fernwood Resort?
Fernwood, yeah, Fernwood.
Which I always thought was funny for obvious reasons.
Fernwood tonight, yeah. You would have thought Martin Mull would have come out there and put out some ferns and started having guests out there. Probably would have been a better show than it. Because Raw
it feels like Martin Mull is exactly the level of cultural relevancy that Vince McMahon would jump on. Surprised he doesn't bring it. I wouldn't be shocked if he brought up Martin Mull next week on Raw.
Well, Martin Mull would be on a top would be a recurring character on a top TV show. So,
yeah, exactly.
That would have been Roseanne.
That was when he was on Roseanne. So,
yeah, yeah. Back to the matters at hand, we had Bret Hart and Ric Flair having strong matches, but headlined by very disappointing gates. In fact, the crowd in the Boston Garden was the smallest in recent memory. Although the other show, headlined by The Undertaker and Razor Ramon, drew the smallest crowd that Dave could ever recall at the Capitol Center. Ramon did what Dave believed to be his first clean job to The Undertaker over the weekend. Now, Hart and Flair did draw 6,200 on December the 4th in Montreal, but that was with kids half price. The Montreal and Boston matches were both in the 28-minute range, with Flair losing via pinfall, and both were strong in the ring. The other cities were around 20 minutes. In Boston, they set up a title match on the January show called a marathon match. Same as the Iron Man match at the Beach Brawl pay-per-view, where they'll go 60 minutes, and whoever wins the most falls wins the bout. Now, the most successful show of the week was on December 3rd in Fargo, North Dakota, which was the grand opening of a new building and drew around 5,700 fans, with Undertaker versus Nails as your main event. Oof. And Bob Backlund versus Kamala as your semi-main event.
I didn't realize Undertaker Nails had house show matches.
Well, they did in Fargo, North Dakota, which if you watch Fargo, Undertaker and Nails seems like the perfect kind of matchup for that town. Now, Phil, the Bret Ric Flair marathon match, that's been in circulation for many years, was taped on the handhelds. What are your thoughts of that match? Because there's a lot of people that have polarizing opinions. Some really like it. Some thought it was too long.
It's been a long time since I've watched it, and I think my tolerance for long wrestling matches has really, really dropped as I've gotten older. So I can't imagine it's something that I'm super eager to revisit. I remember liking it when I saw it the first time, but I suspect if I watched it again, I would think it was too long. It's almost like 25 minutes is too long for me at this point. Get in and out in 60.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you in that regard. The longish match is kind of it isn't the same for me anymore, Vix. What do you think about that? The theory as we get older, you know, our tolerance goes down.
I kind of agree with that. I mean, to a point, when Phil and I saw Rey Mysterio versus Loki live, you know, a few weeks ago, that went 24 minutes, and it felt like less.
So, yeah,
I don't know, which was kind of a miracle since it went on after midnight.
Yeah, that was really good, though. I mean, it's like, you know, if you got to almost hit that level, it's hard to hit that level.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was. Yeah, I mean, you're not going to get something at the level of Rey Mysterio versus Loki in every match.
or maybe more than two or three times at all this year. I don't know. I think I had it added as my third or fourth best match I've seen all year.
Yeah. It depends on who's in it. I mean, I have much less of a tolerance for guys killing time early in a match, which is why I'm still, even though I'm much more into New Japan than I used to be, I'm still really sour on Tanahashi.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing, Dave. I mean, like, if you remember, there was the rumor that Brian Danielson wanted to do like a 95, like a 2 hour match with Austin.
It was a 3 hour match. No, it wasn't even a rumor. It was the Austin Aries match, right?
Well, he was supposed to wanted to do 3 hours, right?
He wanted to do, it was a 2 out of 3 falls match where each fall had a 1 hour time limit. And he wanted to go to a 3 hour draw.
Yeah. That sounds horrible.
Well, you talk about self-indulgent, right? I mean,
that sounds terrible. I remember it was semi-excited about it. It was rumored to happen. Well,
were you at that show?
No.
Okay. Because I remember what it was that they, like, before the match, they announced, hey, fan, like, if you got to get home or whatever, this match could go really long. And they ended up going home. Like, I don't remember when the first fall ended, but I think they went home in total, like, at 75 minutes.
Right.
And then I remember that there was the thing, I guess, was it in the Observer? That it was like Gabe was considering setting up a special invite-only show for fans who would be able to sit through a three-hour match.
Right, I remember that. That was what I was talking about, is I remember the theory of the invite-only show.
I hope they provide the Kleenex.
Oh, my God. Invite-only show. I mean, that played really well. So, like, I wouldn't ever, like, I'm never going to watch the punk hero match again. I just, you know, I can't imagine wanting, like, I don't know if there's going to be 60-minute draws that are going to show up on NWA Classics, but it's going to be tough for me to get myself up for watching them, no matter who's in them.
Yeah.
What's the best match that's been on NWA Classics so far?
I have no idea.
What's the one with the Flair Wahoo matches over 30?
I think so.
Oh, because it's the one from Monsters of the Mat. Yeah, I think that's like 35.
Yeah,
that sounds about right. But real quick, to give you a hint on the attendance figures on those shows, the Boston show did 2,400 fans, and the Capitol Center show did 1,900 fans.
Ooh, wow.
These buildings are, you know, 17, 18,000 plus buildings. So this is telling you, this is, like I said, we're starting to get in that dark period of wrestling, you know, being hot, and it's really starting to get cold. So, yeesh.
Yeah, the 1900. How many do you think the low-key Ray match drew?
I was told, like, the newsletter number was like 2,000, but I think it was closer to maybe like 1,300, 1,500.
Yeah, there you go. That didn't have Ric Flair on it.
No, it did not. And now we go to All Japan Pro Wrestling as we venture into the land of the rising sun. And Mitsuharu Misawa and Toshiaki Kawada captured the 17th annual All Japan World's Strongest Tag League Tournament on December the 4th before a sellout of 16,300 fans paying an estimated $800,000 at Nippon Budokan Hall for the company's traditional biggest card of the year. The live show had been sold out since the first day tickets went on sale back in late October, and Dave believed the event was also close-circuited to several other cities in Japan. The win also gives Misawa and Kawada both the International Tag Team title belts and the PWF World Tag Team titles. Both titles were previously held by Jumbo Shiruta and Akira Taue, but were vacated when Shiruta was hospitalized with a diseased liver. Two key matches were held before the Friday night finals, as on November 30th in Osaka, the two unbeaten teams met in a match which was seemingly going to decide the championship. Misawa and Kawada, then 7-0, wrestled Gordy and Dot, then 6-0. Kawada finally scored his long, that's in all caps, by that day meant several years awaited win over a superstar in the promotion when he pinned Williams. After first going too long, they had teased the time limit draw. Kawada scored the pin in 27-01 with a high kick to the face. However, on December the 2nd, Stan Hansen and Johnny Ace went into the match with a 7-1 record after losing previously to Giant Bob and Kenneth Kobashi, defeated Misawa Kawada.
Did you say Kenneth Kobashi?
I said Kenta Kobashi.
I'm not sure if you did.
I heard Kenneth, too. FYI.
Kenneth Kobashi.
Kenneth Kobashi has joined the York Foundation,
everybody. Yes. Who went into the final night with an 8-1 record. Hanson and Ace and Gordy Williams continue winning as well to finish with 8-1 records. The final night had Hanson and Ace versus Gordy and Doc, and Masao Kawada versus Taue and Jun Akiyama. This match was booked prior to Shirota's illness, so most likely the original plan was for Shirota and Taue to also be in the hunt until the end. The winner of the Hanson match would then face Masao Kawada, provided they won in a playoff match to determine the champions. However, the Hanson match went to a 30-minute draw in what was said to have been an excellent match. This somewhat let down the crowd, who expected Masao Kawada to win, thus eliminating the need for a playoff. Although the disappointment subsided since they had what was said to have been an incredible match, ending with Misawa finally pinning Akiyama after two Tiger Drivers. Your final standings were Misawa and Kawada as your winners, Gordy and Doc, Stan Hansen and Johnny Ace tied for second, Giant Baba and Kenta Kobashi tied for fourth, Akiyama and Taue, for fifth, the Patriot and the Eagle, Jackie Fulton as the Eagle, sixth, Doug Furnace and Dan Crawford, and Abdullah the Butcher and Kamala are next.
Giant Kamala too.
That's right. The Boss Wannabes, Ben Peacock. Then Danny Spivey and Kendall Windham, ninth. And then you had Dory Funk Jr. and Tsuyoshi Kikuchi. And Joel Deaton and Billy Black, the Wild Bunch, finishing out the group. So quite the tournament here, Phil. Some interesting tag teams. This is Misawa Kawada's, I guess you would say, their swan song pretty much as a tag team. But they had a dominant run in the early 90s. What were your thoughts on them as a team?
I remember liking them as a team. I'm sure this is stuff I've seen, but it doesn't sound really familiar, right? Obviously, the All Japan that sticks with you is a couple years later or like a couple years before, right? This was your weird period because you had these great Tsuruta six-mans. And then, of course, you have all the Kawada crew versus Misawa crew stuff. But this period where Tsuruta was gone, but Misawa and Kawada were still a tag team, is a period like I've got very little memory of. But I remember, they were great. I mean, especially when you had them against, Taue and Tsuruta and Fuchi and all those guys.
Yeah, and of course, they're, most known for being the rivals, which started next year, but... This All Japan was red hot. This is when they're really starting to become maybe the biggest promotion in the world at this point. At least the most popular, as they were just turning out all these big matches. Gordy and Doc was on fire as a tag team, and you had all these Kobashi starting to rise up. Akiyama, who just debuted that year, is showing the signs of what his future would be.
Although they did put him on the back burner, even though they gave him the big spot here when Jumbo got sick.
Yeah, because they were starting to go pushing guys like the Patriot and Johnny Ace a little bit higher. Johnny Ace became Kobashi's regular tag team partner and all that stuff. So, yeah, 93 was a very strong year, definitely for All Japan. But Biggs, yeah, this is the beginning of their great run, or not the beginning per se, but the early part of their great run.
The great run really starts in 90.
Yeah, the great run starts in 90, and now we're starting to get into the meat, I guess you would say, of it.
Yeah, in terms of the, Misawa versus Kawada versus Kobashi era. Really what sticks out for me, though, is this is the end of Jumbo as a serious wrestler.
Yes, yes.
Because he had hepatitis B, right?
Yes.
I believe it was B, not C. And he just was never the same. Just such a great wrestler. And I feel like, do you feel like he's gone back to being underrated again? Because I kind of feel like he has.
I think he has, in a way. I think a lot of people got sour on him, but I think
I'd be one of your top acolytes for the soured on Tsuruta crew, right? He'd be one of the guys that I don't know. I like 90s Tsuruta, 90, 91 Tsuruta, and some of the stuff from 89. I think early Tsuruta is super boring. Like armbar long NWA title sort of is dull as dishwater to me.
And, I, and, I, I'm kind of with you in that regard. I mean, I like that stuff too, but I'm much higher on angry, pissed off Jumbo than, you know, the early Jumbo.
Yeah, but angry, pissed off Jumbo was what, like two, three years?
Well, and he also doesn't get enough credit for his role in the Choshu's Army stuff either.
That's when it started turning.
Yeah.
And then when Tenryu turned, I mean, he really kicked into high game when he was with Yatsu, and you know, that was really good stuff. So
that's like 89 to 91.
And more like late 87.
Late 87.
Like mid 92, late 92.
All right, so he had a good little 5-year run there.
Yeah, I mean,
Big deal.
I still like.
Was that a good 5-year young run?
I still like the 70s stuff. The stuff I really don't like is the early 80s Jumbo. I think that's one we can all agree that he was just kind of boring.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm saying, you know, you guys got a guy gets a good 5-year run, you can people go nuts over a good 5-year run. How long has Mark Briscoe's run been?
Yeah.
Because been good for longer than 5 years.
Yeah.
So there you go. If we're going to go ahead and call him underrated, I still got to be the voice for the overrated.
Now, Davey Boy Smith definitely is starting on the February tour. Now, of course, Davey Boy Smith gone from the Royal Wrestling Federation. And interesting that it was, I think, the week before this one, he supposedly was an interview he gave to The Sun in the UK, one of their big tabloids, about how he was demanding 4 times what he was making in WWF to come back to wrestle, which was $220,000 a year. He come out and said that was totally false, that he was misquoted. Ain't nobody paying David Boy Smith almost $1 million a year in 1993. I'm sorry.
And then that All Japan run did not go well.
No, it did not. So
he was not the same guy, and the style had changed, and it was just none of it worked. I feel like he could have adapted if he really tried, though. I mean, when you look at someone like Big Boss Man. Big Boss Man had been gone from All Japan for, what, 6 years?
Yeah.
When he came back. And he had never toured there much anyway. And he had maybe, you could say, the best run of his career.
But let's also be honest here. Big Boss Man wasn't about to explode. Like Davey Boy did this time, because Davey Boy was so juiced up.
No, but I mean, he was still having good matches, though. I mean, and he just didn't – nothing he did when he went back to All Japan clicked, though. I mean, he doesn't even have anything as good as his Vader matches in All Japan.
Yeah, Phil, what are your thoughts about 1993 Davey Boy? I mean, we saw what he was like in the 80s, but it was just – I mean, he had glimpses of, you know, still he could do some stuff, but he was just so fucking jacked.
Yeah, here's the question we were talking about. Big Boss Man a better wrestler than Davey Boy Smith? I think he might have been.
Whole career, or
yeah, just you know.
I'll go with that.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, he's definitely more consistent until the injuries caught up. He had
a better career as far as draw wise for sure.
And I think his heights were better too. I think it was more than just consistent. I'll take you.
Yeah, he was a lead singles heel.
Yeah. Well, if you had to say you've just pure matches, right? I mean, if you had to put your 5 best Big Boss Man matches against your 5 best Davey Boy Smith matches.
He had some of Hulk Hogan's best matches in WWF.
Yeah, those matches were great.
Yeah, it was mainly because of him.
Big Boss Man and Vader matches were great.
Yeah.
Big Boss Man All Japan stuff we were talking about was really good, too.
He actually has an incredible array of guys he had great matches with.
Yeah.
Ted DiBiase, Kobashi, but also One Man Gang and Hogan and Vader and.
Would you throw the match in there?
I think I said Gang. Yeah.
I said Hennig.
Oh, Hennig? Oh, from WrestleMania?
No. Didn't they have that one match on television? Maybe it's Saturday's Main Event or something. I'm trying to remember. They had one match that was on television.
Maybe
for the Intercontinental title.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember it. They worked pretty well together, though.
Yeah, I mean, so he was really good, really.
When I rewatch a lot of that Bulldog stuff, that is a team that does not hold up well.
No.
I remember thinking they were cool when I was 8, but
yeah, they were a product of their time, definitely. Yeah. Now, speaking of big men, one of the Japanese newspapers this past week reported that Baba had turned down requests to return as regulars by both John Tenta and Ted DiBiase, saying that he didn't want to use them because they worked in opposition with SWS, but so did Smith. Pretty sure the Tenta story is true, and there's smoke to the DiBiase story, but not sure how much fire.
And then DiBiase came back the year in 93 anyway.
Yeah, well, DiBiase, I mean, that's Ted DiBiase. You know, there's so much long, you know, ties there and Hansen and all that stuff. There was no way that he wasn't going to bring back Ted DiBiase.
Right, plus there's more of betrayal with Tenta because Tenta was an All Japan Dojo guy.
Exactly.
I would have liked to see Tenta in that run period, early 90s, see what he would have been like as mixed in with your Hansen, Williams, and Kobashi.
Yeah, because he kind of turned into a pretty good worker by that point.
Yeah.
Like,
he was probably his best weight in this time period.
Yeah, and then my favorite Tenta match would be the Yokozuna sumo thing.
Yeah.
Singles, at least. Which is, that's 94, but it's around that this time still. So I
like Tenta a lot in War.
Yeah, I haven't seen enough of that.
It's fun. I mean, they're not great matches, but he's fun in them.
The Tenta and Bubba against Sting and Savage matches were very good.
Yeah, I thought he was his first part of WCW. He was fine, but yeah, of course it would change as time went on. But yeah, I mean, it would definitely be interesting to see Tenta, you know, against Kawada or some shit like that, or Tenta versus Taue. That'd been a cool, you know, singles match.
I bet Tenta versus Taue would be really good.
Yeah.
They'd do wacky sumo stuff together.
do sumo callbacks. Now, you know, we talk about Danny Spivey quite a bit on the early episodes of Between the Sheets.
You mean Dan's 5E male model?
Dan's 5E male model. So despite what has been reported elsewhere, Dave Meltzer says, Danny Spivey and the daughter of the Destroyer, Dick Byer, are now married.
They are now
married because she had called it off at the last minute a few weeks back.
What does that mean? They're not married?
They were going to get married. Then she called it off at the last minute. Then they smooth things over and they got married.
Yeah.
Okay. Because that was very confusing in the notes. Because you said they're now married, even though she called it off. I thought maybe now was not. Are we sure now is not? Is not
now? Yeah, we're sure. Yeah. We're sure.
Now, do you guys know who Dan Spivey's current wife is?
I don't.
Is it Delta Burke?
No, but it is someone. It is another person he met through the wrestling business.
Is he married to Nicole Bass?
No, Debbie he's Cone? Married. He's married.
Well, I'm going to keep guessing. Hold on a second. Is he married to Despina Montages?
No, that's Tarzan Goto.
I know. Candy, I thought they
Candy Devine.
Is he married to Bonnie Blackstone?
No. Bonnie and Joe are still happily married.
Bambi? Is he married to Bambi? Oh, that's Peggy Lee Leather.
Oh.
Is he married to Jazz?
I'd like to see him and Rodney Mack have a fight over Jazz.
That would be interesting, actually.
Who's he married to, Mick?
He's married to
Andy. Is he married to one of the two fat ladies that Gorilla Monsoon used to make fun of in Prime Rizzotti. Is he married to a Rizzotti sister?
Now the Rizzotti sisters came up on both of the podcasts I host this week. That's great. Ann Russo, who was like the WWE office person who was the rehab liaison.
That's right. You talked about this on the show.
When did I bring this up before? Anyway.
Between the Sheets. That's right. Now I remember.
I don't remember why. But anyway, yeah. And so him going into WWE rehab, he met her and they got married. And now they have their own like sober coach. Because he's WWE rehab liaison.
Fucked up rehab liaison starts dating and marrying the junkies that she's putting into rehab. This sounds like a fucking terrible, a terrible rehab liaison, right? She's using her job as rehab liaison as like speed dating. You know, this guy's only
Dr. Drew.
This guy's only on pills. He's this one guy's a heroin addict. I better stay away from him.
I was leaving that opening for you.
Christ,
you don't see Dr. Drew doing this stuff, I tell you. Oh. Wow. So Danny Spivey, sober coach. That's what BH1 show needs to happen.
All right.
Speaking of sobriety, FMW.
FMW.
I don't even know what that means.
Yeah, you're trying to be like me now. The FMW Street Fight Tag Team Tournament. That's right, a Street Fight.
I'm not
Fight
the best voice nominee in.
Well, there's reasons for that. It ended on 12 on December 7th in Osaka.
It was like yet another Chris Zellner anti-Semitism slur. I was also not nominated for best voice. our voices are too New York for the Sheedy Awards, David.
Hey, Phil, I'll ask you a quick question. I've been wondering that. Do you think that eventually the country at large is going to turn against Donald Trump because they think he's Jewish?
He has that sort of cadence, but he has a very like fat, florid Irish face.
You know what I mean? Moving on.
Yeah, this isn't a crossfire. The FMW Street Fight Tag Tournament ended on December 7th in Osaka before a non-sellout of 56-77 at the Furitsu Gym. Of course, the star of the show was Atsushi Onita. The storyline of the tour was that Onita and partner Gregory Verichev, the former Soviet Olympian judo, lost the first four matches of the tournament, simply to put them well out of contention. However, they picked up wins in their final four matches. The rules of the tournament was the final night in Osaka. They would have the first four-place winners from the round robin meet with the winners in the meeting. So Onita and Verichev, who were 4-4, who were tied for fourth with Dr. Luther and Dr. Hannibal, but advanced via a playoff match, beat Tiger Jeet Singh Sr. and Jr., who were second place with 6-2 record, while Tarzan Gotto and Big Titan, first place with 8-0, beat Horace Boulder and the Gladiator, Mike Awesome, who were third place at 5-3. In the finals, Onita and Verichev won in 10-48 when Verichev pinned Titan with a powerbomb. Now here's a question, Phil. Yes. Out of the two tag tournaments that we just mentioned, All Japan and FMW, which tournament had the best teams?
I mean, All Japan probably did. Which tournament, if you said, here's a tape of the matches from what I watched first, obviously the FMW.
Also, I'm trying to remember which Canadian indie worker was Dr. Hannibal.
That's a good question. Now, this tournament may have been the best tournament for social reprobates because we had Big Titan was in this. We've had, Onita.
Who are your jobber teams in that tournament? Like, who are the guys who – we know about the top four, but do we have any idea who your remaining teams were? Like, who are your undercard teams?
It didn't
Who's your equivalent of Billy Black and Joel Deaton? Because that's where I think the decisions get made, right?
It didn't say, although, Tiger G. Singh and Tiger G. Singh Sr. and Jr., ooh. All right, Steve Gillespie.
Cage match, Cage match says it's Steve Gillespie.
Steve Gillespie is Dr. Hannibal.
Who does Cage match say the other members of this tournament were? What? Who were the other teams in this tournament? We only have four teams. We're in a four-team tournament.
Are we sure?
The one team was 8-0.
Okay, wait, let me go to, I'll go to Pro Wrestling History for that.
All right, as we're talking about that, Tarzan Goto and Big Titan were undefeated. Wow, that's a... quite the accomplishment for that one Rick Bogner.
I like Tarzan Goto.
Tiger G. Singh Jr., where does he rank on the worst wrestlers list?
In the history of pro wrestling?
Yeah.
Ooh, he's up there.
Him and his dad.
For those who don't know, that's Tiger Ali Singh.
Tiger Ali
Singh. Is he worse than his dad? I think he was... Wasn't he kind of a passable WWE undercard spot worker?
Like, what do you mean by spot worker?
Like the kind of guy, he was like in the 90s, early 2000s, kind of does a lot of like power bombs, like a tag match with D'Lo Brown. I mean, wasn't he fine at that? Kind of a mediocre way.
Well, he was like,
okay.
He was the manager.
Okay, so here are our tournament teams.
Which site did you find this on? Because
Wrestling Data.
Okay, because Pro Wrestling History just has the winner.
All right, we have Sabu and Kareem Sudan.
Who? And who is that?
Beats the shit out of me.
What happens if you click on his name?
He has no link.
Oh, awesome.
Sambo Osako and Haystacks Calhoun Jr.
Awesome.
See, this is where I knew the gold would be.
Alligator Man 1 and 2 and Psycho 1 and 2.
Which I'm guessing were the same.
Okay,
guys,
Alligator Man.
Different masks.
Alligator Man 2 was Max Anthony. Psycho 1 was Billy Anderson, and Psycho 2 was Tim Patterson. right. Alligator Man.
I'm shocked Psycho 1 and Psycho 2 and Alligator 1 and Alligator 2 aren't the same dudes doing double duty with masks.
Well, they're trying to wrestle each other.
Yeah.
That's where you put Sabu and Sabu's partner under the masks of the alligator.
So Alligator Man 1 and Kareem Sudan are mysterious. So anybody that wants to research for us, well,
is there anyone,
who's the intern? Get your intern to look at this.
Yeah, where's our Tony Reale at to go look for Kareem Sudan and Alligator Man 1?
Kareem Sudan. I'm just thinking who was around back then. That could be
Kareem. It could be Kareem Muhammad.
Was Ray Candy still wrestling?
Was he still alive?
Ooh, when did Ray Candy die?
I think he died earlier than that. Will you type Kareem Sudan?
When did Ray Candy die?
There you go.
Oh, Siri made an appearance.
Ask her who is Kareem Sudan?
Don White. Don White is listed as Kareem Sudan.
Who's Don White?
I don't know who that is. But anyway, let's move on.
That's not more helpful, Chris.
That's what it said. I don't know who fucked Don White.
Well, if you don't know, no one knows then, Chris.
I know, it's crazy.
Professional wrestler Don White?
Who's the guy Jim Booker for FMW at this time period?
The Sheik, right?
Tiger Ajit Singh, I guess.
Was Terry Funk in FMW yet?
No. He wasn't working at this time.
I guess it might be Sheik.
Siri, who is the guy Jim Booker for FMW? <That's
right>. Moving on to New Japan to more important things. Their tour opened up on December the 1st, but they had to replace Negro Casas because he was going to war in January. Not literally. He was going to tour.
He's going to the Gulf. He's going to Kuya, Iraq.
Yeah. So he was replaced by El Engendro. Wow. That's quite the fall off there from
El Engendro is who? I know my name sounds familiar.
El Engendro. He was he's been around for a while. Engendro Jr. works now. He was like a low, I wouldn't say a low mid card. He was like more of a mid-carders type guy. He was a guy that would work mainly your Terceras on your shows. All right. The Heat in the New Japan versus War matches is incredible, according to Dave.
The
current tour opened up on December 1st in Chiba, with the highlight being the Road Warriors as a team. Well, this is the Hellraisers, billed as Hawk Warrior and Power Warrior Kazuki Sasaki. They've been demolishing everyone, winning every night in under 3 minutes and 30 seconds, which is saying something since they've been put in with great workers every night, including beating Hase Amuto on the opening night in 2 minutes and 39 seconds. Now, mostly the main events have continued the Skinheads versus Raging Staff feud, as the Great Kabuki debuted with this group as a member of the Skinheads on December the 1st, teaming with Shiro Toshinaka and Kengo Kimura to defeat Tatsunomi Fujinami, Masahiro Chono, and Takayuki Iizuka with
now,
Kabuki.
Wait, was Koshinaka Skinheads or Raging Staff?
He says Skinheads, according to Dave.
So who was Raging Staff?
The other crew. Kabuki blew a great miss in Iizuka's eyes, and Koshinaka pinned him. On December 3rd, there was a six-man with Raging Staff beating Skinheads when Norio Hanaga, a member of the staff not in the match, interfered, hitting Akitoshi Saito, who teamed with Kabuki and Koshinaka with a beer bottle for the pin. December the 4th saw an 8-man tag match which saw Koshinaka hit with a beer bottle and juiced heavily, but he made a comeback and pinned Hanaga, but the staff came back winning the 8-man on December the 5th. Now, Phil, I mean, this is a great time here in New Japan.
Yeah.
You had this feud going on, New Japan and War. I mean, I know you're a huge War fan. Talk about your love of the New Japan War, all this stuff going on.
I mean, is that like some of the best Japanese wrestling ever?
Great.
I think in hindsight, like, you know, I'm sort of the All Japan stuff has got this sort of technical proficiency to it. But I would honestly much rather see like Tenro in a fat sumo against like Choshu and some other guy.
It's grittier.
It's a lot more fun. It's not as technically interesting.
It's the rich man's Ishii matches.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like if you want to go like a music route, All Japan is like your slick produced.
I know what it is. War is Alice in Chains. Ishii is Creed.
Well, you know, All Japan's like your Phil Spector, Slick Produce, you know, Jeff Lynne, ELO type stuff. You know, right. Heavy production like values.
War is garage rock.
War is like Iggy Pop and the Stooges type level stuff going on, you know. And it's just got – it's grittier. And you combine it with New Japan, which, you know, was the total opposite of gritty. And you just had the styles clash going on. But you have guys in New Japan like the Raging Staff and the Skinheads who they're like the outcast of New Japan. They're feuding with each other. And it's just a great mixture of guys going at it.
Plus you had Hosh guys like Hashimoto and Choshu. Who
and the juniors.
Can get gritty.
Yeah, you got the juniors, you know, Liger and all those guys are starting to peak around this time. I mean, New Japan definitely doesn't get talked about enough. Their early 90s stuff does not get talked about nearly enough.
And you've got the War versus New Japan feud on the junior side, too.
Exactly, yeah. Ultimo and all those guys are coming in.
Ultimo honestly wasn't that good at this point.
No, but he was – I mean, he won the IWGP every junior title.
I know, but you
– big deal.
Yeah, and you have Orihara just getting the crap beaten out of him by Liger. And
yes.
Here's the secret, David. Ultimo really never – not that good at anything.
We know that you love Ultimo Dragon. So you're one of the Ultimo Dragon's biggest fans online.
He's fine, but let's talk about this. Well, he wasn't good yet. When was he good?
I don't know if I didn't know or I had just totally forgotten until the Tenryu bio that Meltzer did a couple weeks ago that Orihara was part of Revolution in All Japan.
Yes, for a very short time. You know, he was like, he was their young boy.
Ooh, what a grim descent that was.
Well, yeah, I guess that Ogawa was part of Revolution too. I don't think I had realized.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, he was the step above Orihara. He was washing. Yeah, while Orihara was washing, Kawada's balls, Ogawa was washing Tenryu's balls in your ball washing dojo deal.
So Kawada just had to wash his own.
No, I said Orihara was washing Kawada's.
No, you said Fuyuki. I thought you said Fuyuki.
No, Fuyuki was washing his own balls.
I'm sure Fuyuki had someone to wash his balls for.
But for those of you who don't know, that's a common practice in the New Japan, All Japan deals where the young boys have to do stuff like wash their mentor's balls.
June is a Mita, maybe is washing his balls.
Oh, man. But anyway, for all you guys, definitely seek out 1992-93 New Japan versus War.
Or just any war. I mean, even when there's not New Japan matches on there.
Oh, definitely. I mean, any war
Except for Akiyoni matches.
Wait, which one was he?
Don Morocco. Oh,
yeah, that's right. When Don Morocco worked in that fake name.
Oh, yeah, those were bad. But like, there's a two match series between Takeshi Ishikawa and Ashurahara, which is some of my favorite under-the-radar wrestling ever, where those guys just absolutely brutalize each other. That are so much better than any Ishii match ever that got five stars.
Yeah, exactly. It's a lot of good
and for stuff. The same thing, right? Where it's like, you know, like that's the other thing. Like, oh, man, these matches are... Was there some match that Dave thought was like the stiffest match he's ever seen or on the almost unprofessional level of stiff from these Ishii guys. And you watch that and go, man, this horror match. It's a horror match. These guys look like pussies. I don't even have to bring up food. I just need to bring up Takeshi Ishikawa.
Yeah, Ishii and whoever Ishii is working with endeavored these matches. They're not punching each other right in the ear and the eyeball.
No.
Phil, can you imagine Dave watching Futen?
I mean, has he never seen it?
I mean, I guess not.
It's not like a lot of people were watching Futen.
He must have watched Battle Arts, right? I mean, you know.
No, he didn't really. I don't think he did watch much Battle Arts.
No, he did actually. He really did.
You had to try to get him to watch Battle Arts.
I know. I thought I succeeded in getting him to watch Battle Arts. I guess I did it.
You tried to get him on the Honma bandwagon back then too.
That's right.
Yeah, it took him going to New Japan for.
Yeah, because Honma and Yamakawa were having those classics, 15 years ago. And nobody was talking about it, but like the Death Valley Driver crew.
Goddamn, yeah, those matches were good. I don't know. I wonder if they hold up or not. But
I watched it recently when I dubbed it the DVD, the January 2nd, 2000 match, and yes, it's still awesome. So
okay.
That's more homework for you guys. Watch Hama Yamakawa from 2000. So go check that out.
Poor Yamakawa, who was it? Wife Beater that ended.
I think it was Wife Beater. Yeah.
Shadow WX. So all those guys.
As good as Honma is/was, Yamakawa was a much better worker than Honma.
And he came at the Journey.
Yamakawa was the best one of those guys for sure.
Yes. The best in New Japan, speaking about the best, Shin Yoshimoto missed the tour since he had his knee operated on, as did Scott Norton for the same reason. Both are expected back for the Dome. Hashimoto vowed to be a new Hashimoto when he returns. And Rikichoshi and Masashi Oagi also missed this tour with injuries. Okay. Yeah, Hashimoto, I don't know if he was a new Hashimoto, but he became a bigger star once he came back, that's for sure.
And I love Io Yagi too, speaking of like underground dudes.
What underrated?
Yeah. I've got a complete knacker in Io Yagi. I haven't done as many matches as I have from some of the other ones, but he's like one of my complete knacker guys over at Shida-nominated Sugita Kaida.
Shida-nominated Sugita Kaida, definitely. Yeah. Now, you know, we talked about gritty earlier. Now we're going really gritty. Okay. Now we go to now, N.O.W.
Truly everyone's favorite Megami Super-funded wrestling promotion.
Yes, as Ryuma Go and Jesse Barr won the USA, that's based out of Portland, tag titles in a steel cage match from Ron and Don Harris on December the 3rd in Funabashi.
Yeah,
that's right.
Those two guys are boycotting Between the Sheets these couple weeks.
Harris Brothers, not fans.
Yeah. When Go made Don submit to the octopus hold in 1928. That was about it for Go, and no word about the future of the belts because Go was fired the next day by the financial backers of the company and accused of embezzling funds, and Masahiko Takazuki was put in charge of the office.
Who the hell is Masahiko Takazuki?
Ultra 7.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's believed Go is going to Portland to wrestle. Gee, I wonder why. It's almost inconceivable this group, which is growing 250 to 350 per show, can survive with Takasugi as their top native star.
Okay, now I have a question.
Correct prediction.
Were they still funded by Megami Super at this point?
Yes, but it was not long before they folded up.
So how does that happen? Like, I get why you would have SWS and PWFG operating independently, funded by the same group, because one's huge style and one's not. But how does your Ryuma Go indie scum group get funded by the billionaire eyeglasses magnate?
I don't know. You know, we know about Ryuma Go's hustling background, you know, to get money. I mean, it's well known he did gay porn to...
that's not exactly how that story goes, but...
Still, he did some.
He did gay porn, or was sort of forced into gay porn to pay off his gambling debts, yes.
So who knows what he might have done to get this extra funding.
And he was arrested for purse snatching.
Yes. He's a very seedy individual, Ryuma Go.
Jesus Christ.
Yes.
I don't know about Ryuma.
He was a great worker when he was younger.
Can you imagine Ryuma Go doing like the Al Pacino cruising stuff?
That is grim. So I assume that
no-sold me trying to take this back around to in-ring wrestling.
Don't you assume that this is... I mean, I assume the reason they got funding is... The reason that I was the way all Japanese wrestling indie promotions get funding, right?
No, but the point is they were funded by non-Yakuza.
Yeah.
Come on.
It was legit, quote-unquote.
Non-Yakuza.
Come on. Let's. I'm sure those eyeglasses people are run by the Yakuza.
Yeah, but they were outwardly legit. They were not.
Okay.
Exactly. Japanese indie scene, there's the stories that you can get out of there. Now, back to Phil. Phil's favorite wrestler, Ultimo Dragon, as we go back to war, made the first defense of his IWGP Junior Heavyweight title on the December 1st War Show in Fukushima, beating Guerrero del Futuro, a.k.a. Jose Luis Feliciano.
See,
how about that?
We've got an Ultimo match you want to see.
Think about that, Phil.
I do want to see that.
Yeah, how about that? He got an IWGP title shot. Yeah.
That exists on tape?
Yes, I guess.
I want to see that.
Well,
Jose
Even if the it's
one,
not, go ahead.
The one lucha show I did commentary on in Monterey, Mexico, had Jose Luis Feliciano as your Mexican commentator. So ex-coworker of mine, Jose.
Yes. The whole taping.
Yeah, the whole taping.
Show.
Yeah, the whole thing was one
was
night.
The first time you ever saw Pancho Tequila.
Right. Sure. No, I saw Pancho Tequila. I saw Pancho Tequila on the DC lucha show that the guy who did the Monterey show ran. And that's how I got like hooked up with the guy who ran the Monterey show. Sal, RIP, probably. As far as I know, he passed away, but I think there is a 20% chance that I'm going to get a phone call from him someday and just fake his own death. But when I worked, commentary on a lucha show run by a con man, Jose
Luis, pro wrestling show not run by a con man,
totally appropriately run by a con man, that Jose Luis Feliciano was your, was one of the guys who did the Mexican commentary when me and Champagne did the U.S. commentary.
That's right. I forgot it was Champagne.
The great Marty Garner.
Great Marty Garner. Former personal assistant.
Right. Champagne. Yeah, that was the show where the two American workers on that show that I booked through Omega were Champagne and Venom, who went on to be Joey Abs.
Jason Arndt, yes. Another great guy.
You're 1 degree away from The Rock, though.
That's true. Sure. I also on that show was a pre-ECW Tajiri. So Tajiri, when he was working, just a big Japan Tajiri, was your other non-Mexican worker on that show.
Greatness.
Weirdly, on that show, backstage, just doing Lady Apache's hair, was Pimpinella Escarlata. And I didn't recognize him initially because it was contextual. Why would Pimpinella Escarlata be doing somebody's hair? And I actually asked him if he could take a look at my hair before I went on camera. See if he could do anything with that.
Hilarious.
Did you also tell me once that he was like in at least semi in gimmicks? You also thought it was an old lady doing her hair.
I think Pimpinella Escarlata is a shoot game.
He's yay, but I don't think he's shoot cross dresser.
I think he's a bit of a shoot cross-dresser. Was the sense I got. I knew it wasn't a woman. I knew it was a sort of a flint.
No, he's not.
Hairdresser.
He does it, but he's not overt all the time like some of the other new ones are. Like some of the newer Exoticos are really out there with it. Right. But he's not. I mean, you'll see him with slacks and a collared shirt, you know, out there dressed up like a guy. But still, yeah, you know the deal. But he's not overt with it like some of these newer ones.
All right, I have one more funny anecdote from random lucha taping in Monterrey, Mexico, that I did commentary on. Carlos Lagarde Jr. Backstage, like on the bus, was wearing like an IWA Mid South Ian Rotten T-shirt. Which actually really like that's a match that never happened that I really wish would have.
Well, also, like, that was like 1998 too.
Yeah, early
IWA Mid South.
Yeah, pretty early IWA Mid South. Carlos Lagarde.
He's a big fan of Gator McAllister, I guess.
Yeah,
this is when they had TV though. Probably
be your big cash flow fan, as we all were.
Maybe he was into Paul Diamond.
Yeah, and there was a point where Bestia Salvaje started booking his own feud against Champagne. Like he kept like trying to put he booked a stare down with Champagne again, a match that never got run, which I really wish could have.
Exactly. What a segue to our next category, too, by the way.
Yes.
JWP, Joji.
Yes.
As Dynamite Kansai became the first JWP world champion, beating Cutie Suzuki on December 1st at Tokyo's Oda Ward Gym in the tournament final. In a playoff match to determine who got the match with Suzuki, who won the round robin, Kansai earlier that night beat Devil Masami. Yeah, we talked about this, you know, these girls performing between the sheets. Yeah, this is a great time in Joshi wrestling, you know. A lot of people talk about the 80s, but I think the best workers were in the 90s, and JWP was a different style than All Japan women were.
A little bit. Actually, isn't Dream Rush like 2 weeks away at this point?
Yeah, I think so.
It was like the 14th or 15th, right?
Yeah.
So it's like a week or two away. I love the Dream Rush main event because it illustrates the difference between the two styles, and that's why that's a great match, is that they work it as this clash of styles.
Yeah.
I remember really liking Dynamite Kansai. Butch, I was always a much bigger fan of your butch lesbians than your femme lesbians for like your Joshi workers. Like, you know, that was always my preference.
So much bigger Crush Gals fan than Jumping Bomb Angels fan.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
yeah.
Everyone is, but I.
Who wasn't? But also like Kansai and Aja and Hota and.
Kandori,
yeah.
Peggy Lee Leather.
Yeah. Sure. Out of those two.
When it came to Peggy Lee Leather versus Bambi.
Yeah, you were for Peggy Lee Leather.
Exactly. Wow.
Wow, indeed.
There's a great
Margaret Cho joke where she talks about about her lesbian experiences and how she says she doesn't like having sex with pretty women. If she wants to have sex with a lesbian, she wants her to look like John Goodman. That's similar to the way that I want my Joshi wrestlers to look like John Goodman. I want them to be women's rugby props, not women's rugby backs.
On that note, we're going to take a commercial break and let the place to be boys pay the bills. And when we come back, we're going to Mexico and talk about Los Sexy Boys.
No, more importantly, we're going to have Tug Taylor and Chaz.
Yeah, exactly. Wow, what an interesting time in AAA. We'll be right back after this.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com, The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and PlaceToBeNation.com. You can check out myself and Scott Criscolo on The Mothership, The Place to Be Podcast, home of great interviews and our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. If you need your fix of current wrestling talk, we have plenty of options for you there, including Main Events, which features roundtable discussion led by PTBN analysts and special guests, our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, including immediate feedback and discussion for WWE, NXT, Ring of Honor, and New Japan Super Shows, and Wrestling with Optimism, which focuses on the positives of the business. Also, be sure to relive wrestling's past with Graham Cawthon's excellent exclusive History of Wrestling podcast, Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave's Wrestling Culture podcast, our monthly pay-per-view rewind roundtable series led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance podcast starring myself and Pro Wrestling Only's Will, diving into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. Sports fans have plenty to dive into as well. We feature The Extra Point with Scott Criscolo and Dr. G, The Kings of Sport featuring live audio wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, The Sports Sound hosted by Cowboy and Cowboy Sr., as well as the NBA Team Podcast, which takes year-round deep dive into pro hoops. PTBN also proudly features Richard and the Mailman podcast, which specializes in the world of TV, thought leadership, anger, and irreverence. As mentioned, all these shows are available on PlacementNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. PTBN is also home to the tremendous in-depth features on pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments, and more. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, Scott Keats, RSPWFAQ.com blog, and Piledriver.net.
Do you watch pro wrestling? Do you love pro wrestling? We do too. And there's only one podcast feed that you can't miss.
PWO PTBN Podcast Network. That's the pro wrestling only Place to Be Nation Podcast Network.
We have a host of brilliant shows dedicated to wrestling past and present.
Whether it's the territories, Japan, Lucha, old school or new school, we've got something for you.
Get a dose of history on Exile on Bad Street with Chris Zellner.
Listen to reviews of current pay-per-views on the PTBN reaction shows. Not just WWE, but New Japan, Ring of Honor, and NXT. And get your weekly update on everything else that's going on in the indies, lucha, and beyond on This Week in Wrestling.
Relive WCW Supercards on Where the Big Boys Play with Parv and Chad.
Join Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave on one of the very best shows for super hardcore nerds, Wrestling Culture.
Go deep into WWF history and discover the Bob Backlund and Bruno Sammartino eras on Titans of Wrestling.
Don't miss the Pro Wrestling Super Show with Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston.
you can get the full archive of Good Will Wrestling with Good Old Will from Texas.
There's Tag Teams back again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze.
Then there's the only pro wrestling game show, Brainbuster, with me, Johnny Sorrow, and a panel of great guests every time.
Get them all on one feed.
PWOPTBN Podcast Network.
You know you want to hear it.
All right, we're back from break, and listen to all those great shows on the Place to Be Nation Network, especially Digging in the Crates, Exile on Bad Street, this show. So listen to all those great shows that you just heard about. Now, we are going to Mexico, and as normal, let's go to our own David Bixon's band to talk about the great people at LuchaShop.com. You mean what? Talk about it, goddammit.
Okay. If you LuchaShop.com, all your finest officially licensed Lucha Libre merchandise. If you want to save 10% on your order, use coupon code BIX. So all sorts of cool stuff there. Still got Ingobernable shirts, although there's no more La Sombra for obvious reasons. What else do we got? We got all sorts of official Rey Mysterio stuff they have.
Eros de Mal. You got the Rudos Can't Fail magazine, Lucha Loot going on. There's a lot of stuff going on the LuchaShop.com.
Yeah,
so
use coupon code BIX, 10% off your whole order.
I did it, so everyone else do it too.
Yeah, so you want to be like Chris, don't you?
Yeah, you should want to be like me. All right, now go to AAA, as we're in Mexico.
Chris just ran from that. That's like, okay.
So
in AAA.
This is when I did this.
On December 4th in Chihuahua, Tug Taylor started a feud.
I completely forgot about this happening like this. All right, on December 4th in Chihuahua, Tug Taylor started a feud with his son Chaz. That's right, from GWF. As Tug worked as the Mass Rudo Cyclops, teaming with Blue Panther and Jerry Estrada.
What a Rudo team that is.
Tug Taylor, Blue Panther, Jerry Estrada. That is awesome.
Yeah. Against Los Sexy Boys, American Chippendale, that's Chaz, Conan, and Love Machine, Art Barr. Cyclops busted open Chippendale during the match, and they kept building the angle up during the show. It isn't known to the audience in Mexico that Cyclops is Chaz's father.
How would they know? Why would they care?
Well,
what would have been a big deal if a father, you know, bloodily beat his son?
Yes, yeah. But you never see that in Mexico.
You don't see it that often.
You don't see it a lot.
Doesn't Magna Guevara work with his kids all the time?
He doesn't, but he doesn't you know, bust them open.
But we had Gran Apache and his daughters. I guess he never busted them open still, but he kept punching them in the face. Although that was in Japan, I guess. That wasn't in Mexico.
Yeah, it's kind of different.
Well, what's the story with Matt? Is Black Terry actually related to Guerrero Maya Jr. or not?
Actually related to Guerrero Maya Jr.?
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember here.
Because there would be your example, right? Because those two did have bloody matches with each other.
I don't know off the top of my head as I look real quickly and see that Guerrero Maya Jr. is in a worked relationship. He's his worked son.
Is that his Facebook status in a worked relationship?
Yeah. Exactly. So he's not his real son.
His real son's the best, though.
Yeah, Black Terry Jr. definitely a definite treasure among the Lucha internet community for giving us great matches to watch.
But he's not nominated for a Sheedy Award like you are.
Well, there's no video people nominated for Sheedies. Now, it isn't known to the audience in Mexico that Cyclops is Chaz's father. Panther ended up doing a stretcher job for Love Machine's Tombstone Piledriver at the Martinet and was taken on an ambulance. So the heels won since the power driver is illegal in Mexico. Panther will be out the rest of the year selling the Tombstone power driver. And Machine is also gone for a few weeks as he was, quote, suspended, unquote, for using the illegal hold.
Just in time for Christmas.
Exactly. Now, Chippendale was brought in to trail and steal the 12-year-old girl audience away from EMLL that the Canadian vampire, Vampiro, controls.
Yeah.
He's going to get a big push in 1993. And there are a lot of ideas on ways to get him over. But thus far, it has been disappointing. and his father isn't getting over at all.
Did either? How long did that last? I certainly
not long at all.
Is this ever on American Galvision?
I would. Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
I certainly have zero memory of ever seeing.
I vaguely remember. I know Chip
the Taylor family and
Luke. Yeah, American Chippendale was on definitely on Galavision, and I kind of remember Cyclops too. I haven't watched it in 20-some years, but
how many months removed from the Bungie match are we? Like 4 months?
Yeah, because that was on the last show. Yeah, it was when we did 92.
That was the last time we did 92. So when it was August.
Yeah.
Okay.
What are the Taylors doing these days, David?
Chaz is still wrestling in.
Chaz was a guest on our buddy Terry Garvin Sims' podcast.
Oh, I didn't see that.
Really?
Yes, which we talk about just about every week now. That's somebody being on that show.
Wasn't he in the Johnny Mantell thing, too?
I think so. So Chaz still works and I think promotes some in Texas. He's still around. He's one of these guys, though, that thinks he could have been bigger than what he was, and
or one of those guys. You think there's anybody who thinks like, yeah, I'm about as big as I should have been?
Yeah, well,
there's one of those wrestling guys who goes, yeah, I was.
He could kind of puts himself out at
GWF, I think.
Yeah, he kind of puts himself over more than what he was. He said that WCW was stealing his ideas and stuff like that. One of those
for
types.
What?
I can't remember. It was on the Terry Garvin's podcast.
They were going to do a GWF invasion. And he invented it. It's going to come in and Mike Davis were going to come in. And,
Well, if they would let Manny Fernandez coming in, I'm all for it. But,
Rob Naylor.
It's an interesting grouping of people in AAA. Those sexy boys. Because Conan still had his... long braids at this time period. It's where he went full bald.
I'm surprised that you weren't. Were you using air quotes there? Since I can't see you.
Yeah, and Love Machine. This is before Los Gringos Locos. So because Eddie had just started the week before as a Máscara Mágica, although he ripped the mask off in the ring and proclaimed himself as Eddie Guerrero. So. I mean, that's the beginning of his run, but
we're still those sexy boys, sort of baby faces. When did
they're full technicos?
Okay,
yeah,
but so why is Love Machine still using the martinette if he, now that he knows that it's a
well little... technicos all use the martinets even to this day. You know, it's just the way it is. Him and Blue Panther was on a blood feud.
Oh yeah.
Now a new Japanese wrestler is heading in called Hong Kong Lee. Which ended up being not a Japanese guy at all, but the guy who would be Pentagon 3. And also headed in is Loco Valentino from Guatemala, which was the second Mosco de la Merced. The second Mosco was pretty good.
Wait, so Pentagon 3 is Pentagon Black or the one after Pentagon Black?
Pentagon 3 would be the one after Pentagon Black.
Right, because first one was... Why am I forgetting his... what's his name?
The first one was the one that got messed up.
No, but what was the other gimmick he had? What were the other gimmicks he had?
Santo Negro, right?
It was Santo Negro. What was he? Oh, he's Sanguinario, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
If you want to have one name to call him by, Sanguinario is the best name, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And then Pentagon Black. I don't even wait. So Pentagon 3 is, I guess, is he around net? I'm trying to remember
Pentagon 3 would have been early 2000s. It would have been 2001, 2004, something like that.
Right, because Pentagon Black was just around for a long time as Pentagon Black in other promotions.
Yeah.
So how many Pentagons have there been now?
There were three Pentagons proper, and now Pentagon Junior. So, yeah, it is what it is. Now, we go into the other side, to EMLL. We got Shogun, who beat Bello Incognito on December the 1st in a mass match at Arena Coliseo, where Bello Incognito was revealed as Andreas Gonzalez. These are more like two of your undercardish type of guys.
Yeah, I haven't heard of either of those guys.
Yeah.
Shogun.
Bello Incognito became...
Well, Shogun's... Shogun was... Is that a... That is that Hashimoto or is that the guy who opened
Bello Incognito? I think
the steak restaurant. Different guy.
Yeah, Bello Incognito was Black Man 2.
I get it.
Later on. He worked as a Raña Negra. He worked with all kinds of different gimmicks. But, I mean, he was Impala. I mean, he was Mexican National Heavyweight Champion once. So, I mean, he was mainly, like I said, a Segunda Tercera type guy on the card. Now, a couple of guys who weren't that way is Orito, the Pequeño Perro, Perrovito, on December 2nd at Arena Nakapan to keep the CMLL Minis title in a match that lasted more than 30 minutes.
Now, which Orito is this?
This would have been...
Is this Mike Segura?
I want to say it is, Phil.
I love that you just called me Phil, that you can't tell our completely different Jew voices apart.
I think he's saying Phil because Phil's a big
Arito Segura guy, but... yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I said Phil because I thought Phil would know, but yes, it is Segura.
And this is the same Pequeño Pierrero that was always around?
Yeah, the same one.
So this could be really good.
Yeah. 30 minutes, Phil.
Could be super good. God, do you think that was something that was taped?
I seriously doubt it.
Like, are we talking, what city was this in?
Arena Nakapan in 1992.
No, if it was Arena Nakapan in 1992, it might have been taped.
So
because there was that those Luchamania tapes.
Maybe. Maybe.
I don't even remember what's on those. It might even be on those.
It's not on those.
No,
we would have known about that.
What was the time you watched those, though?
I would have known if
it's on YouTube.
30 minutes. Mickey
Segura Mania tapes are on YouTube. All five.
Yeah, yeah. Dude has been loading up all kinds of old crazy lucha.
Yeah, they're there. I went through them. There's no Arito Pequeño Perro match.
No. Yeah. Believe.
Now, the only singular thing I remember is I think it's Ghetto Jado and El Samurai teaming together. That's the only.
There were other stuff too. It's on YouTube though. So
if I look up Luchamania, it'll be up there.
I don't know what it's under, but I know it's on YouTube. I've seen it.
Or if I look up Arena Aquapon for that,
I doubt you'll find it that way. Yeah. I don't know. I can't remember. I just know I saw it on there on a guy. Somebody I subscribed to, so I saw it on there. I think it was Dainta Cash, who was the guy that has all this wild lucha stuff. All right, Negro Casas, who we talked about earlier, and hey, of course, he didn't go to Japan, so he's still in Mexico, retained the UWA middleweight title on December the 6th at Arena Mexico as he went to a draw with Triton, not the one that's now, but Pantera when he was under the gimmick.
Ooh, that also.
Which sounds like another good match, doesn't it?
Yeah.
At another arena in Mexico City the same day, which probably pissed the Revolucion, Bestia Salvaje kept the CMLL middleweight title, beating Kato Kung Lee, the first one.
That also could be good.
In 1992, though?
Yeah, Bestia's great.
Yeah, but I don't know about Kato Kung Lee.
Yeah, that's kind of hit and miss.
Yeah.
All right, UWA. UWA announced their 1992 awards. All right, Best Rudo was Connect. Best Tecnico, what a shock. Best Tecnico was a tie between Dos Caras and El Tejano. Newcomer of the year was Scorpio Jr. And your match of the year was Villano Cuarto versus the Pegasus Kid, Chris Benoit.
Wait, Villano Cuarto feud with Pegasus Kid? Or is this supposed to say Villano Tercera?
That's what I mean, that's what Dave had as the results in the Observer, so I don't know, but
the Benoit Viano Tercera feud is 1992, right?
Yeah, yeah. Maybe there was a match they had. I don't know. UWA.
Scorpio, it's weird seeing Scorpio Jr.'s Rookie of the Year, since isn't he now dead?
No, Scorpio Jr. is still alive. Wait, and
am I confusing with Bestia then?
Yeah, Bestia's dead.
Okay.
Yeah, Scorpio Jr.'s main eventing Lucha Legends shows.
Okay.
Also, 1992 was a really long time ago.
Yeah,
you also got to remember that,
Yeah. Now,
course, I'm dwelling. We're talking about Chris Benoit. I'm like, oh, this guy, but
Chris Benoit also.
Yeah. UWA television.
I don't know if you'd you heard.
Was dead 8.5 years ago.
And right? You heard that, David? That Chris Benoit passed away.
No.
Yeah,
no, what happened?
Let's not talk about it.
Now, UWA television ended. Well, I don't think we have it past a certain time in 1992. So, you know, that could have been a match along the way that was a hell of a damn match. Yeah, so who knows? Now, Silver King and beat Loco Zondokan in a hair match on December the 4th at Arena Neza.
That could be interesting.
And on December the 7th at Arena Puebla, Viano Tercero retained the WWF light heavyweight title over our hero, Dr. Wagner Jr.
Wagner was not that good yet, though.
Yeah, this is early Wagner. So he wasn't, you know, the big city wasn't in as good as he was going to get. But Viano Tercero, Phil.
How good would Viano Tercero versus Brian Christopher be in your battle of WWF light heavyweight champions?
He never, Brian Christopher never won the title.
I never won the title.
How about Beyond Tercero versus Poppy Chulo, which we probably have.
I'm sure those guys are wrestling each other.
Tercero against Christian.
Yeah.
That might be okay.
Good.
Yeah, that might be okay.
Or if we're going to go way back, how about Beyond Tercero versus Chris Adams?
Chris Adams held the title when he was in, in UWA?
He was in Los Angeles, or he was doing Mexico at that time, too, so yeah.
They
he
probably wrestled each other.
Champion. Yeah.
I'm guessing Chris Adams had a match against a Viano in WCW.
Viano to serve versus Steve Kern in like 1980.
Ooh. Or Fujinami.
But that wouldn't have been for the that would have been for the junior.
Steve
title,
Kern was a WWF. Steve Kern was a WWF junior heavyweight champion, if I'm not mistaken.
That's what I'm saying. Right, the junior heavyweight title is the New Japan title, the light heavyweight title is the UWA title.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean,
what's the weight class differences between those two? Junior heavyweight's like up to 170.
Do you have any kind of listing of the different of the Lucha Libre weight classes and what they actually signify?
Well, they don't matter. Look at fucking Ultimo Guerrero is a middleweight champion right now. So, I mean, Ultimo Guerrero is a middleweight champion.
How much do you think Ultimo Guerrero actually weighs? Ultimo Guerrero is probably 5'7".
I'm sure he's over 160 pounds.
Are you sure? I don't know.
And you know he's not cutting weight.
Yeah.
Oh, so he
could be shrinking. He could be for his middleweight title defenses. He could be, you know, on cutting weight. You know, like
now
in the steam room shadow boxing.
There are guys that have wrestled for the heavyweight title and like the middleweight title in the same month.
But they actually, I mean, they do. The commission at least used to actually weigh guys.
Ultimo Guerrero weighs 210 pounds.
There's no way that's a shoot.
5'8", 210.
That's not a shoot. There's no way that's a shoot.
Yeah. 5'8", 210. That's his list.
Bobby Foster fought for the heavyweight and light heavyweight titles.
That's right. 50, yeah.
Unprecedented.
Well, Roy Jones Jr. was light heavyweight and heavyweight champion.
There we go.
The last one to do it. Well, we're getting off the left field here, that's for sure.
Yes. Do you guys want to hear a fun boxing story?
Sure.
So I used to box when I was much younger. And I used to fight in this old fight out of this place called Finley's Gym, which was in sort of D.C. and
well,
not
this
the
explains a lot.
Not the greatest neighborhood in D.C. And there was this guy, Bobby Brown, not the singer. But like
sure?
An old fighter, a positive old fighter. He used to. The great thing about Finley's Gym was you had like you know guys who were working out and training, you know, amateurs like me, and then professionals, and then just a bunch of like guys in their 70s who would like sit around playing like checkers and like telling stories. And so Bobby Brown would tell a story about how he was sparring with Sugar Ray Robinson, and he said, you know, first round, man, I was doing everything, man. I was getting Sugar Ray Robinson's ass. I was hitting him with everything. And I'm sitting there at the end of that first round, I'm thinking, this Sugar Ray Robinson ain't shit. I could whoop Sugar Ray Robinson's ass. And then he comes out and hits 9 straight left hooks.
Yeah, these old boxers, man. They're great when they do. When you talk about old guys like that, you see in like gyms and pool halls that tell these stories like that. That's also good stuff.
Just imagine the 9 straight left hooks.
That's some impressive lever punching right there.
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
Sugar Robinson.
And speaking of punch drunk, let's go to our U.S. indie scene and go on the Global Wrestling Federation as Kerry Von Erich's feud with Black Bart continues to be the main item at the Dallas Sportatorium. Besides one early card brawl, the two went to a double countout in the Lumberjack main event on December the 4th to set up the December 11th cage match. Now, have any of you ever seen the Kerrigan Global stuff from this time period?
I've never seen any matches. I remember at the time seeing like one or two segments.
I don't think I have, no.
It's sad. It is sad.
I have a Kerry Von Erich story from around this time.
Okay.
Have I told this before on the podcast or somewhere? I feel like I have. But he was at the 92 John Arezzi Weekend of Champions convention.
Yeah, she told the story. Yeah, well, go ahead. Did.
Okay. He, like, I don't know where. He's walking in the, like, main door that enters the ballroom. So this is, I guess, right after he left WWF. So, like, end of August or early September.
Yeah.
And it's all of a sudden, there's this loud thump. Everyone turns to the door, and it was Kerry like falling down or walking into the door or something. And it was just imagine an entire room full of hundreds of people just going silent and turning around to stare at an addled Kerry Von Erich who just made a loud thump from when he crashed into the room. Yeah. And then I remember once John McAdam telling me that when Kerry was at the Philly convention in January 93, where he had, I guess that's his last match that's on tape, right? Who was it? The one from the ECW and Larry Sharp combined show.
Oh, God.
You know the match I'm talking about where he wears the mask and he does the thing and the...
Yeah.
That he was even in... That he was in even worse shape there because John had said he was at both things and that he literally didn't know his own name.
It's sad.
Sadder because he had gotten cleaned up, too, for a little while.
Yeah, but Kerry's a guy, Phil, that just, he gets a bad rap. I mean, we've seen Kerry have good matches with a variety of opponents. There was always that deal about how Kerry was, you know, only his good matches were against Ric Flair. But, you know, Kerry could go.
Yeah, Kerry was good. I like all of them on Eric's. Kevin never sold anything, but, you know. I mean, none of the Von Erichs really sold everything, but they worked at a fast pace. It was exciting to watch matches.
Yeah, you know, Kevin was like a crowbar, you know, in the ring, but, Yeah, Kerry, man, I mean, very underrated. He's like Jumbo in a way, you know. There's some underrated, but Kerry is really underrated.
And they had a great match together.
Yeah, they did.
Great match together.
Yeah.
That's one of my only early 80s Jumbo matches I like.
Yeah, I mean, they really did have a good match together. Now, I thought this article was great considering who's on the panel. Former St. Louis wrestling promoter Sam Muchnick, 85 years old, was inducted this past weekend into the Missouri Jewish Sports Hall of Fame.
Which is held in a broom closet.
Muchnick was president of the NWA during most of his era as the main power base in the wrestling world. The Missouri Jewish Sports Hall of Fame. Who would be in that, Phil? You think?
I'm not sure. It's Sam Muchnick.
Sam Muchnick?
We're sure this is not some like kayfabe thing where they just invented an award.
Yeah,
it's Sam Muchnick. It's Sam Muchnick, and
I mean Missouri is like one of the homes of the Klan.
First inductee Sam Muchnick, second inductee sports writer Irv Muchnick.
Yes. Okay,
here's the thing. Here's the thing: if it's a Jewish Sports Hall of Fame that allows promoters, I'm sure it also allows sports team owners. So maybe that's who just it is. It's just a bunch of sports team owners and like you know front office guys from you know this baseball accountant. Or something.
They've only had inductions in 92, 95, 97, 98, 2005, 2010, and 2014.
So is there any Mishinoku Pro Masked Man Tournament of Hall of Fames?
Is there any name that you recognize outside of?
All right, I'm looking at the, Chuck.
Because it's not just the Jewish Sports Hall of Fame, this is the Missouri Jewish Sports Hall of Fame.
Nancy Lieberman's in there.
Okay, that's sure. Great women's basketball player.
Wow. All these names listed in the 2014 inductees, I have never heard of.
Read them off.
William Goldstein, he's handball.
Okay, that literally just sounds like they're making up Jewish names.
Ben Colton, racquetball.
And possibly a relative of Cole Cabana.
It's Colton as Kolton.
Well, you know, I had to flee extermination. We all ended up at Ellis Island and named.
Do you think he's just like the best racquetball player at the like, at the St. Louis JCC, and they got him to the Jewish All-Star Hall of Fame?
Maybe. Kathleen Cronemer bodybuilding.
What the fuck?
Irving Londi football. Michael Lacob tennis. Marty Meyer, baseball scout. Greg Belinsky, basketball coach. Then we have Steve Schneider.
Schneider.
Okay. Table tennis, paddleball, racquetball, and handball.
My second cousin Steve.
Yeah.
He never beat him at ping pong.
And Steve Surratt, racketball. A lot of racketball guys.
So basically, like, if there's a – it's the equivalent to my cousin Steve Bix being in a Pennsylvania Comedy Hall of Fame.
Yeah. So there you go.
Or us being nominated for the Sheedy Awards.
All right. I got to make this segue. I got to jump ahead here because of what we just talked about. Oregon Commissioner Bruce Anderson suspended Ron Harris for 90 days, which is why the Harris brothers are now working in Memphis. As mentioned a few weeks back, Anderson wouldn't allow Brian Lee, cousin of the Harris twins, to wrestle because his license wasn't in order. Apparently, Ron Harris phoned Anderson and left a message on his tape recorder threatening himself and his children.
Anderson turned
over to the police and then suspended Harris.
And Oregon Commissioner Bruce Anderson was never heard from again.
Vix, the Harris twins are definitely friends to the Jews.
Yeah, I mean,
I thought Brian Lee was a brother. He's only a cousin.
He's a cousin, yeah.
His name is Harris, though.
Yeah, it's Harris, Brian Harris, but yeah, he's a cousin. But Bix, I mean, yeah, Ron and Don Harris, they are very progressive individuals in their thing.
But
are you assuming that Bruce Anderson is Jewish?
My favorite, I just would assume any threat from the Harris ones are plausible threats. I've seen Sons of Anarchy. Have you guys ever seen the Harris twins during their brief run as blowjob baby faces with long blonde hair in Memphis?
Totally, in Memphis, yeah. That's
the best.
They look like Brian Lee. Yeah. It's hilarious.
The ladies will love these two guys, Ron and Don Harris.
Whoa. Only the blonde ladies will love these two guys, that's for sure. They weren't going for brown sugar, as Dusty would say.
Oh, I'm sure they were. How many illegitimate African American children did Scott Strom Thurmond have? One or more than one?
Well, they could reenact like some type of slave fantasy or something, you know.
On that note, Jim, the former Ultimate Warrior Hellwig,
yes, Jim.
Stop Jim. This before the show gets canceled.
Yeah. Jim, the former Ultimate Warrior Hellwig, did a run in at an independent show in Wilmington, Massachusetts on December the 5th. Warrior did the shot because the promoter, Wendell Weatherby, was his ex-chauffeur in the Northeast. Wow. Supposedly Warrior agreed to do both this against Hercules for $4,000 a piece.
That's very Meltzer language. Do both this and what else?
Yeah, it was nothing else there. That's right. Okay. I think it was a personal appearance or something that somehow got lost in there. He wasn't advertised, but since it was a sold show and supposedly drew 3,000 fans as well, Weatherby had the budget. Warrior, dressed in a trench coat and with no makeup, did a run-in on Playboy Vince Apollo,
awesome.
One of my favorites, and knocked him around before taking off the coat and posing in the ring. He was denounced as being the man formerly known as the Ultimate Warrior, since he's not allowed to use that name anymore. Hellwig gave Wendell a deal because his normal asking price is $8,000 a shot right now. All right, Bix, who is Wendell Weatherby?
Okay, now let's see if you guys remember. How did Ultimate Warrior get fired from WWF two months earlier?
The steroids.
Because he was importing human growth hormone. Now,
yeah.
Who do you think that Warrior had the growth hormone that he ordered from Europe mailed to?
Wendell Weatherby.
Yes. Wendell Robinson.
Yeah.
He was like, it's in the lawsuit. WWE, yeah, of course. This is what I love about how contentious this stuff gets. WWE got a copy of the customs report, which included like the empty box when they confiscated Warrior's Growth. It was addressed to Wendell Robinson. So yes, that's how that happened, and now you know the rest of the story.
So he got fired for getting caught importing.
No, it's even better. Vince had no idea this happened until Warrior told him.
Well, was he Vince's supplier?
No. No, he was like, oh, by the way, I ordered this stuff for me, or me and Bulldog ordered this stuff. Oh. But it got seized at customs, and like, Vince was like, oh, come on. Why are you going to do this?
God damn it. You see Vince dropping a goddamn, God damn it.
Right. Why are you going to be so, you're going to do this now? Really? You're going to order this stuff and then it gets seized at customs?
God damn it.
Was that it for the Warrior until he came back to WCW?
No. No. We had the 96 run where...
Yeah, and I think he did maybe some other indie shots here and there as well in that time period.
Oh, there was the... before he went back to WWF, there was the NWC run.
Yeah, because Warrior was trying to do stuff, but he was having issues. Which
DG, really?
It's the Warrior. Of course he had issues. No, but $8,000 a pop. That's quite the price there for Mr. Hellwig.
How much does Ray charge?
I think Ray. Well, Alberto charges $5,000. Was charging
$5,000. Right? Ray was asking for a lot, and nobody was meeting his price, so he's had to drop it down. I don't know what it is now.
I would think it's at least three, right?
Yeah, he was wanting more than that. I think he was wanting like five figures a shot, and. Yeah, nobody was paying him, so he had to drop his price. But anyway, now on the Smoky Mountain Wrestling, which if you go to the Place Be Nation Network, you'll see that part one of Bluegrass Brawling, the history of Smoky Mountain Wrestling, dropped over the weekend, featuring myself, Dylan Hales, and the Hangman, Tim Noel, which is a great show covering 1992 and 93 Smoky Mountain Wrestling. And some of that stuff that covering that show we'll talk about right here. As Brian Matthews, who holds the mic for the localized promos for this group.
And that is, and there's a reason that Dave was being literal there, because Brian Matthews, not a very good interviewer.
No. Got into the ring for his grudge match team with the Rock and Roll Express versus Jim Cornette and the Heavenly Bodies on December the 5th in Marion, Virginia, which ended with the Rock and Rolls giving Cornette the double drop kick and Matthews pinning him.
Oh, God help us.
So there's Brian Matthews' moment in the sun.
Was Marion, Virginia his town?
I guess so. They're planning starting on Beat the Champ title, similar to the Los Angeles title of the early 70s. It will be a title defended every week on television, with the name of the challenger drawn out of a hat, which means heels versus heels, and faces versus faces type matches. Now, of course, Dirty Dutch Mantel, was the guy that normally drew the names out of the hat, but this, like, spawned some pretty good stuff. I mean, there were some angles that came out of it. Guys working against guys that normally won't work against each other. This had a lot to do with the Tracy Smothers, Chris Candido feud.
And they also had the extra stipulations to it, too.
Yeah, Phil, I like this type of gimmick, the Beat the Champ deal.
Yeah, I think they should do a title that's defended only on the network.
That's one of the things that should have been done forever. You know, since they started Network, was do something like that.
Or even some kind of TV title. So you can keep some of the other main titles for pay-per-views.
Yeah, but the deal where you draw the name out of the hat, it could be anybody from Larry Santo, which is on Network right now, to Tim Horner, to Bobby Blaze, or Tracy Smothers, or Tony Anthony. I mean, everybody was available. So you get these random matches. I know Bobby Eaton was one of the early Beat the Champ TV champions when he had his short run in Smoky Mountain. And had some really good matches. I know Smothers had some good matches as TV champ. It was a fun little deal. So something that should be brought back. All right, on the December 6th TV show, they started the Heavenly Body Stud Stable angle, where Corny said that the Studs were a good regional team, but they weren't at the level of the Bodies. And it ended up with both teams faking sincerity, but Dutch Mantel saying that he was going to be in the Studs' corner in those matches, which shot Corny, because Corny's like, Dutch, you don't need to be in there. You're an announcer now. We're going to have a good, clean, scientific match. You know, there's nothing going to be going on. And it was all that fake deal. But, they did start wrestling, and they started a great little feud there for a while. It was a great three-way feud. where the bodies, all three Heavenly Bodies at this time, Lane, Pritchard, and Eaton, against your stud. Huh?
Not yet, though.
No, it spawned from this.
Yeah.
Then you had the studs, which was, you know, Robert Fuller, Jimmy Golden, and Dutch Mantel. And then the Rock and Roll Express with their third man, Arn Anderson.
Yeah, I remember those promos. I remember that match.
Oh, my Lord. You talk about some great stuff. But Phil, I want you to talk about the stud stable. Robert Fuller and Jimmy Golden. Two guys who, yeah, you know, people know them. You know, remember them in WCW and their gimmicks there. But Continental, they were fucking amazing.
Yeah, they were some of the best. And they were really great when they showed up at Mapfest. They were really great when you'd see them show up randomly in SS, you know, like in Bo James Fed, like in the 2000s. I mean, it's just great. Like, I really wish there was more footage of those guys.
Well, and there was even that. Do you remember that match? It was Jimmy Golden against Casey Thunder, and it was like 2003.
Yeah.
It wasn't Southern States. It was that one promotion that had TV that I forgot the name of. They were on like Comcast Sports South, I think.
Are you sure?
Was that Burt Prentice's group?
No, it was another. It was another promotion. I'm trying to remember what the name of it was, but it was on like I think it was on Comcast Sports South. And remember, no, because I don't remember the name, but they renamed somehow. They adopted the WXO name. Do you remember who I'm talking about?
No, I do think I've seen that match though.
Yeah,
it was awesome. It was like I remember. It was like my match of the year that. It had it was like Ricky Morton and Ole Anderson on commentary or something.
Yeah, vaguely
working a body part and stuff.
Vaguely remember that.
But this is Jimmy Goldwyn. At that point, had been working for what, 40 years?
Yes,
and he was still great.
Well, Jimmy Golden and Robert Fuller are actually working for John Thorne's AIW. He's bringing him in. Yes,
to wrestle or.
He's bringing in Golden to wrestle. I know that for a fact. And I think Fuller's going to be his manager.
Is Jimmy Golden or is Bunkhouse Buck?
They're pictured as Colonel Parker and Bunkhouse Buck, but I don't know how they're going to build in it. But, you know.
Who does AIW? What's AIW?
Absolute Intense Wrestling. John Thorne.
Also like that Fed that has like Eddie Kingston and like.
Yes.
Lewis Linden and those guys?
Yeah.
Who's Bunkhouse Buck wrestling in that? Bunkhouse Buck Eddie Kingston would be awesome.
I don't know, but I said on Twitter last night that Robert Fuller should do the Joey Ryan penis gimmick, and if he did that, then Shoko Dina would have a heart attack. Yeah, definitely. And check out the picture of Robert Fuller gets retweeted all the time.
Oh, I didn't zoom that in. I thought it was Adrian Street.
Of him in his Speedo. And you'll see why. That, Robert Fuller is a legend in the locker rooms.
He's
a
Tennessee stud.
He is a Tennessee stud, folks. No doubt about that. But moving on to the USWA. And aside from the Lawler angle, the biggest news is that the Moondogs and Richard Lee have turned babyface. It happened when Brian Christopher and the Missouri Tiger, Jeff Gaylord, kept interfering in their matches. On television last week, they had a debate between the different managers, and Samples and Prentice beat up on Richard Lee until the Moondogs made the save. The crowd is into the Moondogs' biggest baby faces, and it appears the booking is going in a new direction. Yeah, Moondogs are kind of easy to book as baby faces because they just beat the shit out of people, and you know, it was a great way to get over on the heels. But this was the Moondogs' year, Phil. I mean,
I don't think I've ever seen them as baby faces.
They worked in they were to Memphis multiple times as faces after that 92 deal. Like, I remember Brian Christopher brought in Moondog Spot as one of his guys when he was feuding with Road Dogg and Tracy Smothers and Coco Ware. Yeah, around that time, 96. Richard Lee came back as a heel later on with Moondog Cujo. But yeah, the Moondogs as babyface, I thought was a fun little act because they just beat the shit out of people. But yeah, they're 92 stuff. The Fuller and Jarrett and Lawler, those matches were amazing. Especially that one concession stand brawl, Phil, from
Kennett, Missouri.
Woo!
Oh yeah, one of the best ever.
The last great Memphis, you know, concession stand brawl or whatever you want to call it.
Oh man!
Now, Phil. On the subject of Jeff Gaylord, did you see that photo I tweeted out the other day? And the screen grab and I just put in the chat?
Yes.
What are your thoughts on Jeff Gaylord doing some version of the nudo, as I discovered on WWE Network this week?
Yeah, that is pretty ridiculous. Did he actually lift him?
No.
Okay.
Well,
and look at the look on his face, too.
Well, we see where Mr. Niebla got his inspiration from, I guess, with Jeff Gaylord.
He looks so proud of himself. Like, I imagine someone booked him on, like, a Border Town Lucha show. And someone was dumb enough to try to teach him.
Jeff Gaylord's working, like, Kinect on some Border show. Oh, God.
He's probably working, like, Crazy 33 or someone.
Oh. Or Ari Romero.
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus. Second.
Oh, you would assume he must have, right?
Oh, yeah. How could Jeff Gaylord not get a Mexico gig somehow or somewhere along the way? Way he looked.
Well, also think about, like, I bet that, like, when Mike Lozansky was booking PG-13 in Mexico, that Jeff Gaylord must have come along at some point, and, like, Kinect must have fallen in love with him, and then he saw him work.
Okay. Is there any footage of PG-13 in Mexico? There's not, right?
I don't believe so.
No, I've never seen it. No.
That's a hidden rail.
Totally. Back to the USWA. Tony DiNucci from Minneapolis debuted and seems to be getting a push. He looked good in his debut and even did a Muda handspring elbow. Mike Miller and Mike Samples jumped him after his match and held him down so Burt Prentice could give him a big splash. Before Lawler and Jarrett made the save.
They loved the large manager splash in Memphis.
Yeah, between Burt and Ronnie V. Gossett. They loved that spot.
Burt Prentice had a really nice splash.
Have you guys seen the...
that was a good
yes,
splash.
He did.
Now, have you... Oh, my God.
Ask Mike Rapata.
Oh, now, have you seen the thing where Jarrett and Fuller bring back Ronnie P. Gossett as a babyface to counteract Burt Prentice's Christopher Love?
Yes, it's awesome.
Which is like, because it's just so obviously like, hey, you think you have an overweight, very fey acting manager? No, we have an overweight fey acting manager, and he was here before yours.
You know what's amazing about Ronnie P. Gossett was he was so loyal to Nick Gulas that he worked with Nick Gulas.
Yeah, he was so loyal to Nick Gulas he sold his promotion, even though he didn't own it.
Yeah, but I said he was loyal to him, but he didn't ever work with Memphis and stuff until later on. He could have jumped, you know, whenever.
So he was before he showed up in '89, he was just working for your weird Nick Gulas Outlaw shows.
Yes. So
I did not know that.
Did you see that Vine Kevin Marshall made of him as the Joker?
Yes, hilarious. Ronnie P. Gossett is getting new life on the WWE Network, by the way.
Oh, that warms the cockles of my heart that he's now on WWE Network.
Even though they've censored him saying retard. But,
and Reggie B. Fine's on WWE Network, too.
Yeah, but Ronnie P. Gossett calling the Sportatorium fans welfare recipients is just classic stuff. and Marla Rance, you know, just keep calling the fat slob. You know, all the
over and over that slob.
Yeah. Oh God. Everybody watch.
I don't think he pulled out the Vince McMahon blubber line.
Yeah. Everybody watch USWA and WWE Network. You got to watch it
in the Global Wrestling Federation.
In the Global Wrestling Federation folder. Back to Memphis on last week's television show, they did an angle where two women from quote out of the stands quote started fighting, which led to a match on Monday night. The heel of the two, Leslie Bellinger, is the new valet of Mike Miller. So I guess Lauren Davenport is history. On the different house shows this past week, the babyface, Regina Hale, won via DQ when Prentice interfered and gave her a big splash. So it appears she's done. Belanger faced Miss Texas on December the 7th, and Prentice said he wanted the hormone test on Miss Texas because he thinks she's a man, baby. Belanger won the title when Prentice hit Texas over the head with a cowboy boot. There's something hilarious about that in a perverse sort of way, Dave said. Anyway, Belanger and Texas got into it on TV, and Prentice flashed Texas.
What is even happening with this promotion at this point? Like, what?
They love that shit. They love getting all these random-ass women so they can do all these, like, clothes ripping matches.
But especially in 92-93.
Oh, God, yeah. It was so sleazy. And especially when Eric Embry was there. Remember Eric Embry? I think it was Lauren Davenport.
Didn't Jerry Jarrett do like a torch talk around this time where he had to defend it to Wade?
Yes, yes.
He was like, well, Leslie Ballinger, I forget if it was Leslie Ballinger or Lauren Davenport. She can actually wrestle, but she got pregnant, so she had to leave.
Yeah, I think it was Lauren Davenport. But wow, I mean, Phil, did you ever see any of that 92 stuff where all these women were involved and doing all this wacky shit?
I don't think I have, no. That's really weird, though.
It's a different type of Memphis, man. I mean, it is like full redneck Jerry Springer type shit going on, man. It is wild. I mean, it's wild. It's all Eric Embry booking. And oh my Lord.
It's borderline Rousseauian.
It's so sleazy. I wouldn't expect anything less from Eric Embry.
Sure.
But wow. You got everybody needs to check out
this distinguished jailer now though.
Yeah, I know. Lauren Davenport, Leslie Belanger, and Miss Texas. Which, and that Dave line about Miss Texas getting hit with a cowboy boot and being hilarious in a perverse sort of way is interesting after this week, isn't it?
What happened this week?
Oh, that stuff with Hama and Dave's response to that, which got controversial.
I think that's what the line was about.
Which got controversial. I'm just saying.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So let's look. Look, David's got rent to pay, man.
I was just saying
that was a reference to someone having a foot fetish. It's pro wrestling.
No, I think what Dave was saying was about it was perverse because Texas got hit over the head with a cowboy boot.
But
still, you know how people take you know, words out of context, stuff like that. You know, the whole thing with Dave and his response about Hama, and a lot of people got upset about that. Yeah, it's just... interesting. All right, back to Memphis. Eddie Marlin beat Mike Samples in Loser Must Retire just all last week. And Marlin then announced he was reinstating Danny Davis and Bill Dundee because Christopher cheated in the Loser Leave Town matches. Davis and Dundee teamed with the American Eagles, who had been Davis and Dundee, but are now two other short wrestlers at 8-man at the house last week. Yeah, Danny Davis and Bill Dundee, Phil, were under masks as the American Eagles. For a short time period.
I think I remember reading that. And so they got two other short guys.
Yeah.
That's great.
Which it was Memphis. I'm pretty sure they could find them easily. But that was, I mean, they were building these sounds like a fun ass tag team.
Yeah.
Sure.
And they also had a good feud around this time, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. Now, they're allowing kids under 12 for free and general admission with paying adult the entire month of December at the Memphis House Show. Trying to get that house up, boys. And
they're trying to get the attendance up. That's not exactly getting the house up.
Yeah, talk about your dream matches. Eddie Gilbert is gone because he broke his hand legit about 2 weeks back, but he is now wrestling in Germany. Gilbert had a shot at the CWA middleweight title held by David Fit Finley on December 1st in Bremen, Germany, which ended in a double disqualification, and the title belt is held up pending a rematch.
Now, I've never seen that. How is it?
I have never seen it. It sounds awesome as hell.
It is on tape, though, or another match between them is on tape.
It is?
Yeah. You didn't know that? Yeah.
No.
Why don't we have this in our possession?
I think there's both a handheld and a New Japan commercial tape.
Why would we not have this in our possession right now?
I'm pretty sure it exists.
Eddie Gilbert versus Fit Finlay. I mean, yeah. Shit. That sounds like a fucking match.
Didn't you guys do like a giant purchase from a certain unnamed Northeastern tape dealer of like all of the Germany and Austria stuff at some point?
I wasn't part of that.
So. Someone did. Well,
there's at least a clip of it on YouTube.
Okay. It's probably in the New Japan version then. But I think there's a handheld of the whole thing.
I mean, Phil, can you imagine Fit Finlay working in Memphis in 1992 against Eddie Gilbert?
Man, that'd be the best.
Doing like his that gimmick he first did when he came in WCW as the Belfast Bruiser.
No. If it's Memphis in 1992, he'd have to bring Princess Paula with him.
Oh, yeah, to fit right in. Yeah,
Princess Paula versus Leslie Ballinger.
It's amazing how Fit Finlay never didn't get over in the U.S. earlier. Like Regal, I mean Regal was here not too long after we're doing what we're doing in 93. I mean Finlay would have been amazing earlier in the U.S.
Well, I guess Otto Vons paid good money, I guess. I don't know. Well, he had New Japan, too.
Yeah, that's why I'm thinking, how does he not get it? I'm thinking about him in Mexico.
Well, him, did he ever work Mexico?
He worked at Lucha Taping.
Oh, in yeah.
Waco. The WCW Waco Lucha Taping.
Yeah. But could, man, imagine him like working.
That's kind of that's one of the things. Like, if one of us ever gets loose in the WWE archives, right, is to find the copy of that.
Yeah, fit filming sure. Work at Satanico and like title matches and stuff like that.
Here's a good question for you guys. What if you had one thing that you could that you're pretty sure exists in the WWE vault that you could grab out of there? What would it be?
One match.
Yeah, or you know, show or whatever.
Chris, you go first.
Wow, that's a good question. Because there's a lot of stuff I know was taped that they have that.
You mean like from Crockett?
Yeah, well, Georgia. Even though probably some of those Omni shows from 83.
Well, you know what? No, because they.
No, well. Road Warriors and Briscoes on that.
That's what I was gonna say.
So that stuff like that, like some of the Great American Bash shows that were taped but was never on the commercial tapes from like 85,
which they've released some of.
Yeah,
because they released that Ricky Morton Ric Flair match
and the War Games from 88.
Yeah, so stuff like that's off the top of my head.
For me, I don't know. I'm just trying to think because there's some stuff that. I mean it would just be I feel like that type of thing would be my biggest priority.
Yeah, I think mine too. I think it's pretty obviously like taped WCW shows that we don't have from that period where it was like the best thing, or NWA shows.
Yeah, imagine if I doubt it, but imagine if they have the Nassau Coliseum show from the night before Starrcade 87.
Oh Jesus, yeah, that show that was way better than looking at Starrcade 87 was. Oh God. Yeah, the show that should have been a pay-per-view.
I kind of want to see a lot of your 92, like, Dangerous Alliance, like, you know, your Steiners versus Eaton and Anderson, that kind of, that stuff that was all, where the Omni was made a big deal again.
Oh, yeah. I've thought about that, too, or the, what was it, 45-minute draw, which was Steamboat and Dustin against Arn and Eaton.
Well, I know for sure they taped the Chicago shows because they showed the clips of the matches on
Chicago Pro. They show clips of the Omni match, too.
Yeah, I mean, I know the Chicago was taped for sure, the Chicago stuff.
Come on, WWF, get it together.
I know, right?
Well, maybe they are. Who knows?
Yeah. And that's my note. I don't go... subscribe to NWA. Go pay your $9 a month and go watch NWA classics. Yes.
Or just do both.
Yeah. Just do both. But yeah. Definitely do the one.
Yeah, if you're going to do one, yeah, I guess you know, Bruce Starr has a really good
NWA. NJPW World now is the one that's lagging. By far.
Oh, yeah. They got other problems, too. And speaking of WCW, we close out with them tonight.
Did we say something about WCW at the end of the
season? Yeah, we were talking about the WWE Network.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. Dicks. I know you got migraine headaches going on, so I can kind of explain, I guess, but come on. Yeah, really. We just talked about it. Dusty Rhodes. Yeah,
yes, that's right. We did just talk about it 5 seconds ago. Wink, wink.
That's right. Dusty Rhodes being gone rumor mill. I love this. That's just verbatim what Dave wrote. Dusty Rhodes being gone rumor mill is the strongest yet. It's safe speculation that Rhodes won't be offered anything close to the rumored $300,000 per year he's making as Booker now. He'll probably get an offer and may have already gotten one that is substantially lower, and what happens from there is speculative. At an indie show in Chicago on Saturday night, promoter Sam DeCero announced that Rhodes had given word he was taking independent bookings and that he had a Rhodes versus Dick Murdoch match booked in May. Dusty really shouldn't go back in the ring, except maybe in Florida and Georgia, as he'll mean nothing today as an indie wrestler, Dave said. But Dave guesses you have to make a living. Wade Keller reported that Dusty would have a spot with the WWF waiting for him as a booker, but his wife isn't keen on moving up north. Now, Magnum TA will also not be brought back in his role after his contract runs out on January the 18th. Yeah, where Dusty went, so did old Mag. But, yeah, I mean, Dusty is Booker. I mean, he had many different runs in WCW. So this is just another one of them going away.
Is this the last time he's ever a booker in WCW officially?
As the main one?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Now,
so he was booking during the Watts period?
Yes. Dusty was always the booker. That's ABF. Dusty was booker from when he came back. It's just, you know, people think about the whole Kit Fry stuff as a different deal. But yeah, I mean, Dusty was the guy. He was the booker then. He doesn't get talked about, but yeah, he was. So, I mean, he had a good run. I mean, that 91 stuff is pretty bad. You know, for the summer 91, it was terrible. But they rebounded in the end of the year, and Dangerous Alliance and all that stuff. And yeah, it was a strong run there in 92. And then Watts became, you know, the dictator and pretty much ran everything into the ground. But in 1992, WCW was a hell of a year.
The Kip Fry stuff, I mean, is really, really awesome. It was more hit and miss when Watts came over, really, from the beginning. But, like, every minute of Kip Fry was the best.
Yeah, of course, because Kip Fry was paying bonuses out for guys having good matches. So they were busting their ass.
So Nikita Koloff and Mr. Hughes had great matches against each other.
Yeah.
The greatest non-wrestling person, wrestling executive of all time.
Yeah.
Kip Fry, sure. Yeah.
Totally. And War Magnum was just, you know, like I said, always caught in the crossfire with Dusty. So it is what it is. Now,
around after Dusty left in 89, though.
Yeah, he did. He did. Now, Dusty's being replaced by a committee.
So Magnum TA was the Rob Naylor of the early 90s. guy victim of political hit against Dusty.
Dusty was replaced by a committee, and Greg Gagne was introduced to the guys backstage at Center Stage on December 7th, as he is expected to become a new member of the creative team. Rumors are there will be another key addition, which is Bill Dundee. And if you ask what Greg's qualifications are, considering that even though the AWA was a very successful promotion at one time, its television overall product was always years behind the rest of the country, and only thrived when it was a monopoly promotion in a town, and collapsed under competition many years ago in all its markets. However, Greg was a third-string quarterback when he played college football, and a son of a famous wrestler. That should make him qualify for any job in this business. Thank you, Dave. What you think about Greg Gagne and Bill Dundee, and booking committees in general, Phil? I mean, that's just something that really, the buck should stop at one person, I think, in wrestling. What do you think about booking committees?
Yeah, I probably agree with that. Although, you know, I think the idea of having a lot of different ideas is probably also good.
Right. That's how I feel.
So, you know, you could have somebody in charge, but with a good writing staff.
Well, like, I guess the best comparison would be Crockett in 83, 84, where you had Dory was the head booker, but he had Gary Hart, Wahoo, and Ernie Ladd working under him.
And they were in charge of states.
Right.
So like one
kind of delegated thing.
One was in charge of Virginia, one was in charge of North Carolina, one was in charge of South Carolina.
And Dory was in charge of the whole territory.
And Dory was the guy in charge of the whole thing. I mean, yeah, it could work, but I think WCW this time had like 10 people on creative team.
Right. I mean, I think you do need to have additional people to kick stuff around.
Oh, totally. But there needs to be that one guy or whoever to be the be all end all of it all. Of course, that's the problem with WWE today is Vince is that guy, and look at all the problems they got. But you definitely need somebody that knows what's going on to make the decisions. Now, we talked about the Steiners earlier. Jim Ross said on the Ross Report on the WCW Hotline on December the 5th that Rick and Scott Steiner left WCW because they didn't get the best advice from their lawyers, saying it is a disturbing trend growing in sports where lawyers and agents want to disrupt negotiations to get as much as they can for their clients. Ross also called the Steiners injury prone and that they were starting to get in the slump anyway. And speaking of the Steiners, there are no plans for the World TV title now that Scott walked out as champion without losing it.
I'm going to let Phil comment on that line about lawyers.
Yeah, Phil, what are your thoughts about JR's thoughts on that disturbing trend in wrestling?
I mean, it is pretty funny with JR as you're like, Republican anti-union guy bitching about guys having representation. These athletes making too much money as opposed to the giant corporations. I mean, wouldn't you assume?
I don't think he is.
Really?
All right. I think he's like Cornette. Yeah.
But that is a very...
Yeah, but you know where that line comes from. That's Bill Watts. You know, I can see JR saying it, but Bill Watts' voice.
Sure.
Coming out of JR's mouth. Yeah.
But yeah,
these goddamn agents. You know, they're ruining sports.
We need to have these guys are great athletes, but they don't have the minds for business. Really surprised that's something you said about Ron Simmons.
Yeah. Okay. We got to keep these Jewish negotiators out of the wrestling. You know.
By the way, that reminds me. So on the March 86 episode of Mid-South that's on the network now.
Yeah.
I totally forgot about Eddie Gilbert's kept man gimmick.
Yes.
Where Bill Watts keeps talking about how Eddie Gilbert is living on some older woman's money.
Yeah, that was a short-lived deal.
Yeah, and then he's like, maybe I'm just an old-fashioned male chauvinist, but back in my day, we used to have a word for a man that lived off a woman, and it was a four-letter word that began with a B. And I'm like, wait, four-letter word that begins with a B? I'm like, Buck? And the consensus on Twitter when I tweeted this was that he thought bitch had four letters.
B-I-C-H?
I guess.
Maybe.
Remember, this is a guy who wrote a long, like, religious screed about when he let another guy blow him that it wasn't gay.
Oh, yeah. Bill Watts is a really great wrestling promoter back in the day.
Yeah, he was.
But... you know, problematic in many other ways. I mean, he's better than Fritz.
When was the Bill Watts blowjob story?
You don't know about this? It's on his website.
I know, but when? What time period are we talking about? When did it happen?
Like young adulthood, I think he said.
Wow. Oh, man. I just got some thoughts in my head. Oh, my God.
What?
Just think about what stuff Bill Watts would say. To the guy when he's on
the team. He received no gratification from it. It was for that homosexual. I believe his words were something like that homosexual's oral stimulation only.
So he did it. He was like a mensch? He was doing it as like a mitzvah?
He was no selling. He was no selling.
What the idea behind it was? It's like, for the hell of it. Go ahead, buddy. Who am I to tell somebody no if they want it?
Gives working stiff a new meaning, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's not good if you don't make eye contact.
Yeah. Larry Zbyszko is the full-time color commentator on WWE Saturday Night now. Bix's friend, Larry Zbyszko, who was running AWA Invasion angles in 1990. So Larry and Jim Ross actually was pretty fun the short time they lasted as a team. Because I think Jim was actually excited to work with somebody besides Jason and Bobby Ventura.
So, I always liked Zbyszko.
As an announcer, yeah, I like Larry as an announcer. No doubt.
VHS.
Yeah,
I mean, here's the thing. Like, when you're running 5 hours of TV a week, it's tough to find new things to say.
Yeah, he had his go-to lines, which everybody does, you know, as announcers.
Yes. Oh, okay, I found the Bill Watts thing, and I elect that Chris being the one that has a southern accent read this.
Okay. All right, as you're doing that, we'll talk about Ron Simmons' new theme debuting on the December episode of WCW Saturday Night called Don't Step to Ron, which Dave Meltzer implicitly said, it sucks.
As far as that album goes, it's not bad. By the standards of the Slam Jam album, it is not that bad. But
maybe.
Only by the standards of Slam Jam album. Now, okay, yeah. I just put the Bill Watts thing in the chat.
Okay, here's what Bill Watts said. Certainly the sins above mentioned we cannot overlook in our judgmental pride of being heterosexual, and I personally have been so guilty of them, and in my depravity of these abominations have so grieved the Spirit of God as I transgressed in them, including even foolish but not innocent homosexual experiences Not that I ever participated in committing a homosexual act myself, or even homosexual touching, or being touched, or have entertained any homosexual feelings, but allow myself to be orally gratified. And that one strictly one person's oral stimulation only. By this homosexual at one point in my life. In my youth, as I reached that age of puberty and hormonal rages and sexual exploration and worse, even allow myself to be gratified by this homosexual for financial reward, as many of us young athletes did, quote unquote. And I'm also speaking here in some of these athletes who became real stars in their sports, so we are not talking about just ordinary people or ignorant or poverty trap victims, but some exceptionally gifted athletes.
He means black people and really successful black people.
Yeah, as we were preyed upon by this influential and wealthy pervert in our youth, which is not in any way, excuse me, in this abomination. Yes, he also preyed on others, the non-athletes, too.
Okay, so rereading so, but, that, I'm trying to
figure out. Is that Jim Barnett?
No, it's not Jim Barnett. He talks about how he's still involved in amateur. This was written in like 96, but talks about how he's still involved in like amateur wrestling in Oklahoma. See, I can't tell if he's making it sound like he was underage or if he wasn't. It sounds like he's like, it's tricky.
Yeah.
If he's underage, then he was abused and whatever. He shouldn't even have to be trying to excuse him. That's shitty. But if he was an adult, that's.
It sounds like some guy paid him to blow him, right? I mean, is that what
that's what it sounds like? Yeah,
like somebody gave him $100 to blow him. I love the fact that he said even any homosexual touching or being touched.
Yeah,
how does this guy give him a blowjob without touching him?
the guy was gifted with his mouth.
His mouth was really, really wide open.
Yeah, he was gifted.
He lived the whole time without touching him at all.
He didn't have to worry about no teeth.
Yeah. Well, we know it wasn't Leroy McGuirt, man.
It was
because he's blind. He would have to touch to get down there.
Well, so long, everybody.
All right, back to WCW. Paulie dangerously is scheduled for a few matches with Medusa over Christmas week. Although he's telling people he won't be working those matches. Since his contract is as a manager and a commentator and not a wrestler, he once again wasn't booked for television tapings this week.
And I presume he was ceremonially fired and then sued the company within a few weeks.
Yeah, this is that time period where Paul went Jew crazy with his lawyers. And that's Bill Watts would probably think. That's probably Bill Watts' thinking. He went Jew crazy with his lawyers.
Well, he allegedly falsified like travel reimbursement stuff, I guess.
Yeah.
And then he sued the company because they couldn't actually prove it and got a big enough settlement that he lived off of it for the next year and a half. And possibly longer, depending on how you view his ECW tenure.
And see, you know, as I said, you know, the Bill Watts stuff we were talking about with lawyers and, you know, agents earlier. I mean, look at Paul. I mean, Paul's dad, lawyer, stuff like that. So the Bill Watts is... asshole puckered up every time he had to talk to Paul.
I forget, where was it that Watts said that, it was on Jim Ross's podcast that he's like, what was the word he used talking about what type of his sect that he, about how ridiculous it would be for Paul Heyman to call him anti-Semitic because he loves Jews. It was what, Messianic Christian?
Maybe? I guess so.
Right. He's one of these, like, you know, a lot of like conservative Republicans. Really, really pander to pro-Israel groups because they need the state of Israel to invade Mecca to start the apocalypse. So it's like one of those things. No, I love Jews. I want them to start World War III so Jesus Christ can come back. Then they'll all burn in hell, of course, but I need them to be there to start World War III so Jesus Christ can come back.
But aren't there also some sects where it's like where Jews do go to heaven?
No, that's all dogs go to heaven.
All Jews go to
hell. All Jews go to hell.
There's Jews for Jesus. I know that.
Right, Jews for Jesus. Yes, we call those Christians.
Yeah, but that's like a set. I mean, yeah, but they
Jews for Jesus, Messianic Jews, those are the same thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a Christian group that pretends they're Jews.
Yeah, no Jew has any respect for Jews for Jesus Christ. I don't know if you knew that or not.
Wow.
No, you won't get a bigger reaction from any
favorite Jews. You start talking about Jews for Jesus like they're a real thing.
Yeah. All right, back to WCW. Nobody from WCW has even made contact with Davey Boy Smith, which is almost mind-boggling considering the potential revenue England and Europe have to offer at this point. Well, they did eventually make contact with Davey Boy Smith, as we talked about earlier.
Yes, it didn't take long.
Didn't take long. He was in the fold soon enough. And in our closing bit of WCW, and considering the timing that this was out, that Dave wrote this up, I don't see how he didn't see what was the writing on the wall in this whole deal. Because
I'm gonna this was intriguing. He did and couldn't say.
Maybe.
Well, who's his best friend?
Yeah, well, yeah. All right, here's what was going on.
WCW, are you his best friend, David?
No.
John D. Williams is his best friend? I don't know who his best friend is. Who is his best friend?
Not best friend. Brick Flair.
Oh, okay.
All right. WCW has been running legendary matches from 1989 on a Sunday Main Event show. No word.
1989, that championship year, I believe.
Yeah. Now, no word on how long they'll include segments like this, but if for the first week was an indication, it was a success. The November 29th main event program, buoyed by the 1989 match for Chicago, where Ricky Steamboat beat Ric Flair for the NWA title, drew a 2.7 rating, which ties the highest rating for any regular cable show in many months. Dave's not sure what this says. When a tape of a three-year-old match draws more television viewers, i.e. more casual fans, than the first run of the Flair Savage WWF title change, let alone just about anything else that has been on television since last winter. This past Sunday,
probably drew better ratings than the stuff drew in 1989.
Yeah. This past Sunday, they aired the Flair versus Terry Funk match in Baltimore, and they clashed Flair and Sting versus Dick Slater Great Muta match, and announced that this coming Sunday, they'll be airing the Thunderdome match, Flair and Sting versus Moon and Terry Funk from Halloween Havoc. Now, this is interesting. Obviously, the motive of all this is ratings, and at least it proved to be a major success the first week. How long this will hold up, we'll just find out. The arguments against it are obvious. Since it airs the top heel of the opposition in a very favorable light, quote, and as a babyface, no less, unquote, not to mention it airs a level of heat and excitement and match quality that the current product can't come anywhere near, which makes the current crew look bad in comparison. From the standpoint of ratings themselves, it's a short-run positive, and it's probably only planned for the short run. I can't see it helping houses of the pay-per-view, but it's designed solely as a ratings getter. As far as show quality, it does make the show a lot more entertaining. Okay. All right, here's the underlining deal. Ric Flair is coming back to WCW, so what better way to hype up his return than to show some of his best matches from 1989?
Well,
and if you notice, all the matches that they were airing from 1989 included Ric Flair. There's no way around it. And the fact that you couldn't see this, you know, if you're supposed, you know, if you're in the, because it wasn't just Dave. Wade reported the same way about this. So if you can't see what's going on here, then, I mean, I don't know. Because why would they be spotlighting Ric Flair so much on their television if he's working as one of the top heels for the opposition?
Wasn't it just a little chicken the egg? Because isn't there at least a version of this that the reason that Watts got the go-ahead to come back, or that TBS Brass asked Watts to get Flair to come back, was because of the ratings this did? I mean, isn't there a version of the story that is told like that?
Maybe, but I don't think so. I mean, I just think that Flair didn't want to come back anyway. He said that. So.
Yes, but he was still working on top at this point. It was after he stopped working on top is when he got his release and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, but we're in December. He was still, I mean, he left in January.
No, but he was still working with Brett for another couple weeks.
Well, yeah, but he was still working on top through the end of the year.
Now, question. I'm trying to remember. Were these all just on regular main event, or did some of these... I could have sworn they extended the show to 2 hours some weeks.
Yeah, I mean, Flair was working on... And by the way, Flair was working on top at the end of 92.
Yeah. No.
I'm looking at results now. He was working on top and at the end of December.
Well, they just mentioned the crap house shows he was doing with.
He was working shitty.
The story was always that he had his handshake with Vince that if he stopped being booked as a top guy, he could get his release, and that's what happened because as soon as he stopped working with Brett, he wasn't working on top.
All right, I'm trying to find out when his last Brett match was.
I think he worked with Brett even on the European tour on his last dates, but I think it, for all intents and purposes, it was done around the Iron Man match, which was the 9th, I think.
January. They're going. I'm looking past that. They're working all the loops. They're working the next weekend.
That's when he was being blown off.
Then they're doing the Raw with Flair and Perfect. The 18th, which was taped that night, so that was his last match. He main evented the next night in Sarasota. He worked in Reno against Perfect. Then he was in the Royal Rumble as the first man in the match. He worked Perfect at Madison Square Garden, so he wasn't the main event. Brett was working Bam Bam Bigelow, but if you look at the placement of the card, Perfect and Flair was the main event. Okay. He's working Perfect in New Haven, Toronto. Then they go to Europe, and he's working Brett there. Really, only worked Perfect just a handful of times.
I guess so, but anyway, I ate this stuff up when it was airing.
Oh, yeah, it was great to see that again, because that was such a great year.
And, I mean, I hadn't seen any of the pay-per-view stuff up to that point.
Oh, you hadn't?
No. I mean, I didn't have a VCR yet or anything. So,
how about Flair? Here's a match from Germany. Flair versus Boss Man.
Landy might have that on YouTube or something.
Interesting.
Or on Daily Motion. I think.
Phil, I mean, Flair.
Flair versus Boss Man?
Yeah.
You think that exists on tape?
I think they taped all those 93 European shows, didn't they?
Yes. Now, Flair, you know, when he went back to WCW, what were your opinions on him coming back? You think it was time, or do you think maybe he should have, you know, come back sooner, or should have come back later? What do you think, Phil? Phil.
Yeah, I think it was about time, although I don't think it was ever really that great.
You know, well, for his return stuff.
His return stuff. I mean,
well, they booked the fun him, so stuff shit, with,
yeah, I mean, the thing with him showing up and doing the...
Well, he met his crew in Paramore, though.
Yeah,
was that Fifi?
Yeah, you didn't know that?
No.
Fifi's been his live-in girlfriend for like the last, 3 years?
Wow, I did not
But
know
he
that.
Also met Paul Roma.
And Paul Roma was his live-in girlfriend. Wait, no.
Right, that whole thing with him doing the stupid... Flair for the gold and the Roma horseman. I mean, it was pretty bad. Some of the matches were okay, but...
What was the idea behind Roma anyway? Was like someone thought he was a more handsome Tully or something?
I mean, well, Tully they tell the story that Tully was
no, I know that, supposed
to be the guy, and Paul Roma was just there. They put him in.
Just there. Paul Roma was just in Atlanta for some reason.
Well, he was on in the locker room. They were bringing him in, but they just put him in that spot. Okay, we'll put you here.
Really?
That's pretty much what.
I heard that version of it. Where did you hear that?
I mean, that's what I understand, was there was no long-term plan. They just threw him in there.
And Tully was there, but not...
Flair didn't know... So Flair, to the story, didn't know until they did the skit.
Who was it that introduced him? Arn?
Ole.
Or Ole.
Oh, because Ole was the booker. So, yeah. Oh, booker's named Ole, as John McAdam once said. But anyway, that's our show tonight.
There's more than one booker named Ole?
No, you know the whole, you know, yeah, you know the what I'm talking about. Phil, plug section time. What have you got the plug for?
Well, SugunaKayeda.blogspot.com is our blog. Sheedy award nominated.
Sheedy award nominee without its own domain name.
Yeah, the one's .blogspot.com. So it's got SugunaKayeda in there. So we've every day for, we've put something every day for something like 2 years now. So we're really, you know, check that every day. I'm doing a complete and accurate updated thing every day this month. So we're going to review a new Regal match. A Regal match is a
Fujiwara matches and Black Terry matches and Jose Lothario matches.
Oh, I have to jump in. Are you going to review Regal versus Ace Steel?
I already did review Regal versus Ace Steel. Somebody does not check the Webby, the Sheedy Award nominated Sagunda Kaita.
What day did you put that up?
It was like a couple days ago.
Okay, I have to look. I didn't even watch the match yet, so I'm curious.
It was pretty good. Okay. It was fun. It was very, as I said in the review, it was kind of Regal, a little Regal by the numbers, in the sense that Ace Steel was just kind of a guy and working a Regal match.
I love that we had no idea this existed.
Yeah, I didn't know until I saw your tweet.
Yeah, I didn't know until I found it.
Yeah, reviewed it on Wednesday. Okay. So go check it out. It was fun. I mean, it very much was like Regal doing a Regal match and Ace Steel being a guy psyched to be in a Regal match.
I think my understanding was that Ace didn't even know he was going to work until Regal showed up and said he'd only work with him.
Wow, really? So the idea was that Regal was booked for the show, but he would only work Ace Steel.
I'm not sure. Like it was for the Noah seminar thing that they do.
Oh wow! I would have loved to see
that. Was scouting or something?
I think there's some fun guys Regal could have worked at WLW besides Ace Steel. It's a fun match. So we reviewed that on there. I just reviewed a Regal Christian handheld match from Dublin, Ireland in 2010. I just put that up. So. I'm going to do another dig into the crates pretty soon. We just bought a condo, so I've been moving and unpacking and all that kind of stuff for the last couple of weeks, so I haven't done one in a while. But hopefully before the end of the year, I'll have another one of those up and look at aspen.us for the 5 best ideas of the day if you're interested in public policy. And that's it. If you want LSAT tutoring, shoot me a DM on Wrestling Only if you need to take the LSAT. I don't think I have anything else to plug.
Well, Biggs has got no plugs for everybody, so Biggs, go ahead and shoehorn all your plugs in.
What?
What you mean, what?
Plug something, man.
I don't know. Let's see. Fighting Spirit. I guess we're kind of right in the middle between issues right now, but, you know, the thing with the one I did with the article about Terry Funk is still available and is the latest issue. So check that out. 605 at 605pod.com. Me and Brian Less put up another episode this week, which, you know, hopefully it should be weekly. For now, we're
You need to capitalize on all this 605 stuff for the network. Because everybody on Twitter is calling the show 605.
Yeah, I know, we really need to. I mean, we're not doing the show about just that, but we do talk about some of the network stuff, though, again.
I'm just saying, it's so weird, though, because I've never really heard it called that. It was either, WCW or TBS.
Or WCW Saturday Night. Well, I want to call it WCW, but it's not WCW Saturday Night, so people don't want to call it that either.
So they start calling it 605. You know, it's like, Bix's podcast just started up right before this happened.
Yeah, it was good timing. It's fortuitous.
Yeah.
So, 605pod.com. We also talk about Pibe Diaz, the second Pibe Diaz, and his unfortunate accident in Titania's NL ring, and which is one of the craziest things you'll ever see. The story we found turns out to be the whole story about tying the Team Challenge series, and how that was kind of interesting, and also our memories of Vince Russo's radio show that we had here as a kid. So lots of stuff like that. And this week on our next episode, Brian is going to talk, at least in part, about how Vince Russo was at his bar mitzvah and how he booked Vince Russo and Skull Von Crush at his bar mitzvah, which included Brian as part of his bar mitzvah defeating evil Nazi Skull Von Crush. And the whole story about his mom booking Vince Russo and Skull Von Crush for his bar mitzvah.
Now, are y'all going to review Vince Russo's current radio show with your buddy Sean Ross Sapp?
Why would we?
That's your. He took your ex. Your old job.
I know. Can you imagine what I would have done with that?
For those who don't know, Bix used to do the post Raw podcast for Wrestling Inc., and he was replaced by Vince Russo.
Well, I left, and then Vince Russo came.
That's really hilarious. Funny.
Anything else, Bix?
Figure Four Weekly. I guess, yeah, because right, we're recording this, I guess, different time than usual. Last week's had some concussion lawsuit. Well, sort of. Concussion lawsuit update stuff this week. I'm going to probably have at least a little bit more on that because talk to Jerry McDivitt. Yes, really. And got some.
You talked to Jerry McDivitt?
Yes, we'll talk about more off the air.
You our Lord and Savior, Jerry McDivitt?
Yeah, I know I did not bring up that we're considering doing a podcast about him. Maybe eventually.
Or have him on.
Yeah, I'm considering it. I'm considering asking him. So have some clarifications and some additional stuff on that. Plus, I think I'll probably have some stuff about the current WWE Network thing going on with all the old footage. And I guess that's it for now, as far as stuff I can think of. My very secret projects that I allude to, some more stuff happened with one of them this week. So that should be coming soon, and I'll let everyone know, obviously, once that's actually live. And yeah, I guess that's it for now. Follow me on Twitter at David Bix. Follow Chris on Twitter at Chris Zellner. Follow Phil on Twitter at I don't remember how exactly his Twitter name is.
I think it's Phil A. Schneider. I'm not exactly sure either.
It's Phil. I believe it's at Phil A. Schneider.
Okay. Just follow me on Twitter. I occasionally retweet things. You're not going to get a lot. But
you retweet good things. Yes, you're not as prolific as Tom.
It's okay. No, you should follow Tom on Twitter.
Yes. Follow Tom on Twitter at T-K-A-G-E?
Yeah.
So T-E-A-K-A-G-E-E.
Yes.
I think, right?
Yes. Yeah. You should definitely follow Tom on Twitter.
All right. Okay. Now, Bix has uploaded my Twitter, so I ain't got to worry about doing that. So now I'll just skip to the latest episode of Exile on Bad Street, which I talked about earlier in this show. Bluegrass Brawling, Part 1 of the History of Smoky Mountain Wrestling with Dylan Hales and Tim Knoll. Talked about 1992, 1993 Smoky Mountain, all the hot angles, hot feuds, all the great workers, talkers, all that stuff that was going on back then. It was going to be just one show on the whole thing, but there was no way in hell we could have did that. So we split it up. Part 2.
I can't believe you even planned it as one show.
I was hoping to get in as one show. Well, that was foolish by me. But part 2 will be coming probably next month or so when everybody is able to get back on again and do it. So, check that out. Of course, this show every Monday. And go ahead and plug next week's show because we have a week decided.
Oh, we did?
Of course. You don't remember this?
No.
December 8th through the 14th, 1988.
Oh, that's
right.
We did. Okay.
We go to 1988 for the first time. And there's a great reason for that, as one of the greatest, worst pay-per-views in wrestling history took place that week that is a must cover, believe me. Super Clash 3. That's right. So be ready for that.
And for the first time, we're going to have a 1988 show with Matt Watch.
Yes, that's right. And we don't have a guest officially yet. But believe me, you know, this show, we always have the highest caliber of guests. So be on the lookout for that. Other than that, I think that's all we got. So for Phil and for Bix, this is Chris saying so long from the Peach State of Georgia.